get to the bottom and throw that straight in the face of that damn monstrosity.
Right.
God help us then.
Whoso dwelleth under the defense of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty.
If when this document is discovered, the people of Britain are bound to a state machine, my message to posterity is rebel.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 11th of July 2025. Streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say as we do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from the Temple of Port turned merchant venture of Fortress. More to say about them this week, I hope. The Tampon Charlie's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or the Apple App Store, but easiest place to get it is thisweek.org.uk. It's a whole page of a range of different options. Get it updated if it hasn't got all the latest links from the new website, which we swapped over to about 3 or 4 months ago. But don't try and get it from the evil Google Play, you won't. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with zero trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions or boring us to tears with distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. Quite often, of course, revisiting great crimes of the past, like the 7/7 London bombings this week, just to reinforce the lies, the official government narrative that doesn't hang together at all. So using these anniversaries as an excuse, really, to twist history. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers, against World War III or against wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to all the multiplying crises, whether that's Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, the climate, of course, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies are crafted, if you haven't worked it out yet, to make every crisis worse. And the politicians, those useless, lying professionals, have nothing to say, nothing at all. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to the AI, which is used to make big decisions because it takes the human element out of decision-making, or dead. So Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience. And meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they're interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, like with the jabs of a doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the Fourth Reich of the World Economic Forum, as well as the free world of free speech, it's Matt O'Brannan here as a free speech activist here in Bristol, Kiwi. This week we're going to be hearing from Neil Goodwin, who we had a quick clip from last week, but he's an old friend of mine from years and years ago. And Neil is now disabled, and he's now a disabled activist and a filmmaker. So he used to be a filmmaker. He made the film Operation Solstice, which was shown on Channel 4 in the 1980s, all about the Battle of the Beanfield with the Thatcher government smashing up all the trucks from the peace convoy on their way to Stonehenge. And we also hear a bit of an exclusive this week. It's Don DeBar from New York talking about the man who he thinks probably killed Jeffrey Epstein in his cell. And he's got some pretty hard and sharp evidence to back it up too. And afterwards, guess what? This guy came off death row because he was in Epstein's cell. And he's no longer on death row. Isn't that nice? And he might even get out of prison. How about that? So Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and then from PRSC by the trans lobby, but not cancelled off here yet. Anyway, welcome, Matt. Nice to see you again.
Kia ora.
No Martin this week. Well, Kia ora, what does that
Kia ora.
Mean? That's a kind of orangey drink, isn't it?
It was when I was a young child, when I was in England, but back in New Zealand, it is a Maori greeting, but also quite a ubiquitous phrase for many things, really. You can use it a greeting as a farewell, a bit like ciao. The exact meaning is a bit open, you know, in different arenas, but I believe the best interpretation I've had explained to me is that it means be well, and that's how I use it. So, you know, whether it's a greeting or a thank you, it's like be well.
It's Maori,
it's a wonderful thing.
Maori?
Yes, Maori. So you don't give anyone a choice. You don't say, I hope you are, have a nice day. It's just like, no, be well. Like, I'm not giving you a choice, be well.
The Maoris, obviously, I had quite a bit of chit-chat with them when I was in New Zealand. Mm. And I can always remember, they were quite assertive lot. Generally mm-hmm. quite big mm-hmm. and very sporty. Yeah. And I always remember one of the T-shirts, one of the guys actually was at the airport as we were leaving. A big crowd of Maoris. And his T-shirt, I never forget it. It said, "Don't bro me till you know me."
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah, I feel like that's more of a thing here. Like, back in New Zealand, maybe because I'm just a bit alty, you can say bro to whoever, whether they're, you know, Palangi white or Māori, and never get, you know, a funny look. Not me, personally. But I found here, if I'm just interacting with a stranger who might be, I don't know, African or what have you, I'll say bro, and I sometimes get a funny look. Like, I get that look, like, nah, you can't call me bro.
Well, the Freemasons like to use bro.
Do they?
Brother.
Really?
Oh, I said, well, brothers.
Oh, yeah,
brother
yeah.
this and brother that. Actually, the monks yep. used to do it. But I mean, here it's a bit like
and
mate.
Muslims
it's like
when someone. I love that actually. Yeah. I love that.
It's like when someone calls you mate. All right, mate.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, and you think, well, who are you? You know.
Yeah, yeah.
You're my mate. No, you're just trying to be over friendly. And I can see why. And in a weird way, from a London background, mm-hmm. I could see exactly what this Maori guy meant by this. Don't bro mm-hmm. me till you know me. It's like don't be over familiar, please. Mm-hmm. It's a bit patronising.
Yeah, it can be. Can be right.
It can
also
be
lovely. Just depends, isn't it?
Yeah. So, look, we're going to let you lead the news agenda this week, Matt, and
cool.
start off
here
with...
Here we go.
You see, you're going to actually throw everything up in the air, aren't you? Because normally mm-hmm. what I do is I leave some of the
Usually
bigger
do.
International stories until, like, after the break. But I think it'd be nice for you to sort of take charge, take the reins, because you've got some important stuff that's just literally been breaking today, haven't you? You're more up to date than me on quite a lot of things, I think, actually.
Wowzers, that's a big claim.
So, Unite the Union...
Yeah, right. Okay, that is a good one. So I've just literally seen Matt Kinnard, great journalist, just tweet that Unite Union has voted overwhelmingly to boycott Israeli, you know, weapons. And he's saying that's huge because Unite Union represents many BAE workers who are manufacturing the different parts, including the F-35 parts. So this is huge, huge, yeah. Tony's pumping his fists in the air for those who don't have spy cameras on us.
Oh, I'm not allowed to hang on. Oh, you actually can support Palestine, can't you? You are still allowed to, just about.
Palestine, yes, for now, but you definitely can't say, I support Palestine Action.
Okay, you mustn't say
which,
that. No,
which I've done many times this week. Maybe you haven't followed that, but I've
so
been...
So as a spin-off from...
I have been doing that.
Moving
I've been
swiftly
walking
on,
around.
Right?
Well, it's too late for me. You don't have to say it. So I know I've been like... I wore a sign this week saying I support Palestine Action. I haven't been picked up yet. They may bust in the door, but, you know, I think you guys are safe. But there is a strategy to do this, and that Defend Our Juries are doing...
Well, anyway, as a spin-off from that, mm-hmm. Telegraph's just reporting Unite has suspended Angela Rayner and could abandon the Labour Party. Unite is to reconsider its relationship with the Labour Party in a move that could trigger a financial crisis for Keir Starmer.
Yep.
So she has been suspended over the Birmingham bin strike. Actually, this is to do with the way that the bin strike has been going on in Birmingham, and again and again.
What did she do with them?
Well, she has been involved in the negotiations, probably from afar, as the government often are. They're saying, "Well, you go and negotiate, but we're really going to tell you what you can do." So the strikers, for those that don't know, were months the bins haven't been being collected in Birmingham,
right.
Because of a massive IT misspend on loads of software, which proved to be useless, and they had to spend more and more on it, one of those little scams. Birmingham City Council ran out of money, so they couldn't afford to empty the bins anymore. They had loads and loads of nice, shiny new computers, but no staff to empty people's bins. And so they decided we're going to force everyone to reapply for their jobs, give them less wages. And they said no. And, of course, people of Birmingham have to be suffering. So Rain has been involved in this negotiation. She's one of the people who's very hard-nosed and saying, no, we're not going to give them any more money.
Right. Yeah, so she hasn't helped them out. It is a shocking story. I haven't followed it too closely, but I've certainly heard from one of the speakers at the last event they had in London, and yeah, he spoke very well. He talked about how, you know, you don't have a living wage. This idea that you don't have to pay garbage men to do the dirty work is so ridiculous to me. It's sort of like, if it's not an easy job or a pleasant job, the least you should be able to do is put a roof over your house head. If you're going to work a full-time job, you know, it's kind of preposterous, isn't it? It's
disgusting. So 1.2 million members of Unite the Union. They used to be known as a Transport and General Workers Union. It's what they call a general union, and the largest trade union in the UK.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful and very powerful that they are talking now about defunding labour. Like, it's a huge, important step. We are seeing other alternatives come through finally. I believe it leaked sooner than was intended, but yes, there is a Jeremy Corbyn option, and there is, it's not quite clear what that's going to be, whether it's a party or a coalition of different MP independents and the Greens. I think that's more what we're looking at. So I think the cat came out of the bag quicker than expected. That's the kind of the word on the ground. But yeah, that's happening. That's positive. And the Greens' new popular rising to the top leader in waiting, Zach, has got
Zach.
Many good. What's his last name? You caught me there.
I don't know. Zach Goldsmith. No, but he won't be him.
He's really good.
It's I'll
Friday.
Check your work,
hot.
We'll find it. Yeah, okay.
A bit delirious. What is it? So, but he's great. I challenged him on Assange, and he said that he'd at least look at how we can...
Polanski.
That's it, Polanski.
Roman Polanski.
Yes, that's right. That's why I always struggle to put those two together. He's very different to Roman Polanski in many ways, but he seems to have very sound policies. He's not afraid. He's speaking up on Gaza. He doesn't mix his words. So it does seem like the type of leadership you'd want in the Green Party. So, yep, go Zach, keep going. So there'd be this, you know, and I don't, you know, yeah, I think there's going to be like a coalition of these different independent groups and voices that we could, that we can support. And that's what the Unite Union
The Labour Party don't care, do they? They're just going to get loads more money from their World Economic Forum mates.
Yeah, perhaps.
Big corporates will go, don't worry, they'll take care of Starmer. Mm. They'll stroke his hair and they'll say, it's okay, we'll find
perhaps.
You another million.
That's, yeah.
10 million, whatever it is. What did you want? In fact, the banks, they can just go and press a button and make the money up, can't they?
Yeah, I would assume so, but it won't be easy. It's quite a big chunk, as I understand it. I can't give you an exact figure, but it's not small. It certainly will be a bit of a stress for them. And what it does do is strengthen the independent alternatives, as we are, you know, talking about here. And there is 18% support for Corbyn, you know, the theory of a Corbyn-led initiative. So that's a good start. And, you know, I think it's not hard to win these elections if you just speak to what people actually do care about.
Yeah, but it's hard to stay credible, isn't it? I used this clip from Norman Lamont at the start of the show last week where he said, I think it was in 1991, the Tory Chancellor resigned. In his speech, which was considered devastating at the time, he said that we are in office, but we are not in power. Mm-hmm. And you do get the sense of that with Starmer. In fact, amazingly, it's all a year on since the general election, where Starmer got his resounding win, promising change. Was there any change? No. So
a little bit. Huffington, get a little bit worse.
Huffington Post, very good. Huffington Post this week reporting Keir Starmer's government has sunk to its lowest ever approval rating after a year in power. The government's hit its lowest ever approval rating, according to a damning new poll. YouGov carried out a poll to mark Labour's first year in power, found that just 13% of voters are now happy with the party's performance. By contrast, over two-thirds say they disapprove of how the government is doing. That gives Starmer administration an approval rating of minus 54, the worst figure it's ever had.
Can't say I didn't warn people. I did a video about this before the election saying, do not vote for Labour. You know, everyone was so amped up to get the Tories out. And I was like, nah, look at who Starmer is, what he's done. He led the persecution of Assange. He was one of the key, if not the key figure in that whole episode. He was secretly flying to Washington. That's been revealed since with records from Washington. The UK records were destroyed, but not the US ones, for secret trips. And while pretending it was all about extradition to Sweden, so that whole thing, you know, effectively tortured the century's greatest journalist. Then, as a human rights lawyer, he said on TV that Israel has the right to starve an entire civilian population of 2 million people, half of which are children. Cannot think of anything worse to say on an election campaign. And then we elected him. Oh, my gosh, people, this is a crisis. You know, we are at the point now, guys, where we have to make actual change. So get out. You know, we've got to do something. We've got to change the system in terms of the donations, in terms of first past the post. We've got to get a mixed representation system and support independence.
What do you make of Corbyn's so-called comeback? Because you've been following that for a while, haven't you? He's now apparently getting together with Zara Sultana after the banning of Palestine Action. She's so disgusted as a Labour MP with this that she's now teaming up with Corbyn and the other independents, ex-Labour people or similar to Labour people in the Commons, as a sort of, and we've got, on the other side, we've got Reform getting a few extra, a couple in the last week or so. We've had two, including an ex-chairman of the Tory party, although he's no longer an MP, he's now Reform. So what is going on? I mean, you've got Reform on the one side and you've got Corbyn and his mates on the other side as well. And the main parties in the middle seem to be both disintegrating.
Dive bombing. Yeah, I mean, both of those parties are just becoming more and more beholden to the greedy power at the top, and doing less and less to be able to say they're doing anything for ordinary people. Like I say, it's not actually hard to push those buttons. Cost of living crisis, end the war in Gaza. War, it's a genocide, isn't it? You say those two things, you're going to win, but they can't, because the powers that be want those things very, very much. They very much want to ethnically cleanse Gaza and take the $2 trillion worth of natural gas. Rishi Sunak's wife shares an Infosys, which UK BP got the contract for from Israel before October 7th in 2023. I don't know how Israel could sell Gaza's natural gas before they had conquered anything, but they did. Which kind of shows you the writing was all planned. And but Starmer's in on it too. Doesn't matter if it's a Conservative or Labour. And that's why, you know, I was saying that Labour are more Tory than Tory now, and I was right. You know, they came in. I believed that on foreign policy. I wasn't quite sure on domestic. But my hunch was that they wouldn't be any better. And in fact, they've been worse. Starmer tried like heck to cut disabilities to, disability payments to fund NATO. So horrific.
Yeah, even so we'll get on to Gaza, but we're going to have a little look at Reform first, because when yesterday's announcement of the former chairman of the Tory party defecting to Reform, I mean, it's like it could become, it seems to me, it's like rats leaving the sinking ship. Kerry Badenoch's got to put a brave face on it as the leader. But it's just a matter of time before more and more people just say, well, we've had enough of this. So let's have a listen now to the report. I think it was on the PM programme yesterday, and some clips of the Tory leader, Kerry Badenoch, what she had to say about it. But also, of course, about her non-opposition. What do you make, before we hear from her, what do you make of the non-opposition of the Conservative Party to the disabled cuts?
Non-opposition to
they
cuts.
Should be opposing. They're in opposition.
Yeah, right.
But actually what's happened is Labour have now taken over the Tory role. So the Tories just sit back there, fold their arms and laugh.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's to fund... It's obviously to make up the deficit that Trump wanted Europe to spend on the NATO, so that US
they've said they are now. And in a way, you see, what he was doing, he's a sneaky little man, because he was saying, oh, I want to leave NATO.
Yeah.
But actually, really, he didn't want to leave NATO. He just wanted to threaten
Europe
the Europeans to pay more.
Yeah.
And now they are.
Yeah, I think that's the best guess of what he's doing there. Yeah, you might like to think that, yes, he was willing to do it at any cost and stop funding NATO. But yeah, probably it's a means to an end just to spend less. And have Europe foot the bill too.
Okay, well, here's Kerry Badenoch on the Today, no, sorry, the PM programme, talking about these two issues. Firstly, the defections from her party to reform and why it doesn't matter, and which is, of course, she's got to say, I suppose, and of course it does, but also on welfare cuts, which it seems there's a great big consensus. We're going to have to make the disabled people pay for war.
The former chair of the Conservative Party, Sir Jake Berry, is off to reform, accusing his former party of abandoning the British people because they no longer stand for low taxes, free enterprise or secure borders. His departure follows that of the former minister David Jones earlier this week, and of course there were others before that. In the past half hour, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, responded to the defection whilst outlining her plans for welfare reform.
This is something which I say again and again, that there are a lot of people who come into politics just to play the game of politics, and they will follow polls and defect wherever they can, like they do in banana republics, to wherever they think that they can win. We have to do more than win. We have to be ready with a plan. This is what Labour got wrong. They had no plan. They were just focused on the election, and now they're in government and they're completely at sea. They cannot deliver anything. All of the people who are not interested in coming up with a proper policy plan and just want to jump ship are welcome to do so, because when the time comes at the next general election, the public are going to be looking for a serious, credible alternative. We are the only serious, credible alternative. Getting the welfare bill down is not an impossible task, but it requires conviction and the courage to make difficult choices. First, who needs and deserves our support? There will always be some people who need help from the state. People who have a really challenging disability. People who have worked and paid into the system for years, but who lose their job suddenly through no fault of their own. But we can't afford to be spending £1 billion a month on benefits for foreign nationals.
So £1 billion a month being spent on benefits, but really the reason for this, a lot of it is, well, for example, with disabled people, I don't know if you remember, this is probably 2012, 13 or something like that, they shut down something called REMPLOY, which was an organisation set up by Winston Churchill after the war to help employ disabled people. That was all shut down by the LibCon coalition government. And disabled people are now supposed to go and fight out there with the economic migrants, with everybody else, for a job. And at the end of it, there's no guarantee, with the wages the way they are, that they're going to get a route out of poverty at all, or even off benefits. They may still be having to claim benefits while still working, as well as the fact that often these are 0 hours contracts where there's no guarantee of work. So at the end of the week, you think you might have had a job, but actually you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these things are just getting worse across the board. We're all knowing that. And it won't change until we make it. You know, I don't think we can sit back anymore and say, oh, this is terrible. You know, it's we've got to actually do something. We've got to support these independents. And the fact that Unite is going to look at defunding Labour and put it into these party means that we will have some economic support behind us. So it's not, you know, that is huge for us in terms of grassroots campaigning, support for these initiatives like Jeremy Corbyn, Zara Sultana, and the Greens, Zach Polanski. They are talking the talk. I mean, in terms of credibility, Corbyn is proving it, you know, and, Zara and Zach also looking very strong, talking the talk.
But it's so, almost as if the government is thinking, Matt, it's like, we don't care, actually, because we're in government. Our approval rating's gone down to -54, the worst figure it's ever had. So we don't care, actually. We're in government. I liken them a bit to the Israelis. It's a bit like the Israelis don't care what people think about the genocide.
Yeah, they think they'll get away with it. And it's also that it's like the way the Democrats would rather lose to Trump, even though they pretend – Like their main policy is, oh, anyone but Trump. But they're happy to lose to him rather than support someone who can clearly demonstrably win in every major poll by a long way, like Bernie Sanders. Even RFK Jr. was doing very well. If they had replaced Biden when he had to step away with RFK Jr., he's basically Democrat royalty. You know, the son and nephew of two, you know, great political figures there. And so he was polling on 15 to 80%, even though not getting any mainstream coverage. So they just slid him in and boosted him with all their money. Like, boom, he wins. You can stop Trump. They don't want to stop Trump. They want to keep the gravy train running. So it's a bit like you say that they're not really in control. They're just playing along and serving the real masters. You know, the big money interests behind them. And they get to keep the trough going, whether they're actually in or not. They're still getting donations. They're still getting, you know, or is it bribes, you know, behind to keep on going. You know, they get funded to run the campaign for next year. It doesn't really matter to them whether they get in or not that much.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it? So, you know, whatever you want to do, Matt, as an activist, or I want to do, we simply have to just sit there for 4 years and watch this nightmare carry on with a bunch of people that aren't really Labour, but pretended to be Labour and managed to get in on a lie.
Well, I definitely push back on that. That's the real tendency, isn't it, to get despondent and say, oh, there's nothing we can do. But history has shown over and over again that is absolutely not true. It just does take work, and that's why it's really tendent, you know, because you will encounter defeats, you know, but getting despondent doesn't help. There are more of us than them. We have to organise. I believe one of the keys is to get off first past the post system, because it just leads. That's what they have in the US and the UK and Canada. No other Western countries do. And it is one of the key ways that the two-party system remains, and you don't get a viable alternative. They just become more and more alike and conservative. And, so getting off that, and also capping donations. You just can't have an equal election if campaigns can corporations can buy votes
so they're coming for the disabled people. They've come for the disabled, but they didn't quite manage that, although of course there are quite a lot of cuts to the disabled benefits that have gone through, which have almost not been noticed by people. So who are they going to go for next? The disabled people are like the low-hanging fruit, aren't they? They're the people that can't fight back,
right? Gosh, yeah, you put it like that, it's shocking, isn't it? And the other thing I just can't is profound about that, disgusting to me, is that they're doing that to make more bombs to bomb people overseas. It's like, okay, they're taking money from disabled people here to make more disabled people in other parts of the world by bombing them. You know, it is really that horrific. And when you boil it down, I don't know where will they go next. Any thoughts?
Well, I did ask this to Neil Goodwin, right, who is one of the activists in his wheelchair down at Downing Street last week, and he got arrested. As he explains, that the police have got these pixie, what they call the pixie one and pixie two, where there's a disabled person being arrested, so they can wheel them into the van up a ramp. On their mobility scooters when they've been arrested. So the Met police have got these things ready, but they didn't bother last week. They just, as he explains, they just bundled him into the van, even though he can't actually move.
Wow. The guy dressed as Charlie Chaplin as
Now, did you
Adolf
guess?
Hitler.
Yeah,
oh,
we
that
had
was
a bit
amazing
of
amazing footage.
Anyway, here's
That's
Neil.
Historic.
This is Neil, who was dressed as Charlie.
Really?
He calls him Charlie X.
Oh,
that's
wow.
his name. And he's, as
oh,
he explains
brilliant.
Here,
brilliant.
He's the police in
well
the past.
Done to that, lad.
The police in the past have said, why are you dressed as Adolf Hitler? They'd never heard of Charlie Chaplin. You know,
oh,
but anyway, let's have a listen to Neil, old friend of mine, filmmaker from the Battle of the Beanfield and various other films. He did the M11 protests in the 1990s. Great film about those. And those were the days where people like Neil, who was just out of the London College of Printing, doing a video editing course, documentary making course, as a teenager
right.
in his 20s,
I suspect that he was
suddenly
an
artist. He's making films and they're going on Channel 4. You know, a couple of weeks later after he's made the film, because Channel 4 was like that in those days, as he explains in the longer interview. But let's have a listen to him talking really now about, Neil, about what was going on last week.
They weren't going to wait around for suitable, you know, this van called codename Pixie One, which has a little winch at the back and can take me on board in my mobility scooter. They wanted to get me away as quickly as they can. So three of them picked me up basically and dragged me, well, not dragged me, carried me to a van and then dumped me on the floor of that van. And then like, okay, well, you can get on the seat now. And it's like, well, no, I can't move my legs, you know? So because of an MS. And, so then they kind of scratched their head and had to kind of get in. And then, you know, it was awkward. Bearing in mind, I'm dressed as the great dictator. So, and I said to the guy eventually, like, is that CCTV working in the van? Cause, you know, I'd love to see footage of you basically manhandling a severely disabled man in this way. You know, cause of expediency, because you need to get me out of the way as soon as possible. And luckily someone filmed it, and I think last look, 200,000 people, and about six to 8,000 people have shared it. 200,000 people have watched it, so it's out there, you know. And also,
so why did they need to get you out of the way so quick, do you think?
It's Wednesday, and I don't know. I don't think they thought it through. I think they panicked. They had a big demonstration opposite, a huge, like, pro-Palestinian demonstration opposite. And I don't know, it's just weird. I mean, you know, I think they just made a bad decision. I mean, anyone can see that I've got a completely fused neck and spine. It's not just the MS, but I've got ankylosing spondylitis as well. So you can, if you look at me, you can kind of see that I'm fused. I can't move my neck at all, my neck, you know? So yeah, I mean, and also the police in the past have waited. I mean, they had to wait a few hours to get this van. The last time I got arrested as Charlie outside the carriage entrance, which subsequently I got off on. You know, I wasn't convicted, but I won my case. But they waited for a van, you know, called Pixie One. They've also got a Pixie Two, two vans. To deal with, I mean, in the past, to get you to the station, they had to sort of beg passing cabs to sort of like, can you take this person in a wheelchair? We just arrested them, to the police station. The cab driver's gone, no, mate, it's not my job, mate. You know, they just haven't got the logistical wherewithal to deal with severely disabled
access to a
people.
Black Mariah.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think that's from what I gather is that they backed down because they didn't want, you know, I went to the demonstration, the welfare, not warfare demonstration at Downing Street a few weeks ago, and literally they've got like 100 people with disabilities turning up on their doorstep with their carers. And, I mean, you know, the fuss they had to, they had about 10 cops waiting for me to get that one van. But imagine if you had 20, you know,
I mean,
disabled
what do
actors.
You make of the disabled cuts? Because this is, I mean, many people are pointing to this and saying you cannot take these benefits away from disabled people. Disabled people rely on this. And if they don't get it, they're going to get suicidal, or they may just die.
Yeah, yeah, it's PIP is not just, I don't know, there's all these like nasty stories about Ferraris or people buying, what, you know, whatever going on or whatever. It's survival. It's you know, the amount of money, if you look at my bank account, it's like buying things like perching stools and grabbers. You've got to keep the update of your scooter. You've got to keep the update of your stair lifts. You know, you have to pay for all that stuff, and it comes out of the PIP. It's survival. It's a leg up into actually existing in the world, you know. And that's what they were taking away from people. And they're highly stressed. And with MS, you get stressed, you get spasm attacks. And, you know, and other people have got conditions where stress really affects them nastily, you know, and exacerbates their symptoms. So it's just like, you know, what they've done basically is stress people out who really didn't need to be stressed. So it doesn't surprise me that people were suicidal, you know, it's making a bad situation really worse, and it's cruel and it's unnecessary. And the sooner we get rid of this Tory like government, the better. Actually, worse than the Tories. Actually, I don't think the Tories should even pull this one off on disabled people, they wouldn't have dared, you know. But Starmer, who I don't know. Okay, so he represented a couple of people in the 90s from the libel case, blah, blah, blah. You know, but let's face it, Mr. CPS, for years and years, he's an establishment figure. He's got in, he's nobbled the Labour Party, he's destroyed it under this, anti-Semitism smear that was put out, the big lie, you know. And that's where we're at now. Hopefully, you know, an alternative will come to that, you know, out of Corbyn's new party. But in the meantime, direct action, civil disobedience is our only recourse to holding these people back.
Well, what about Nigel Farage? He is apparently, if there's an election tomorrow, which there won't be, but if there is, Farage is going to have a 50-seat majority.
Exactly. The Labour Party, with their centrist policies, not actually dealing with what people have been screaming for all these years of austerity and Tory government and, you know, misrule, you know, been denied winter fuel help, denied, you know, windfall taxes. Now they're hammering disabled people, you know, complicit in a genocide in Gaza. You know, the Labour Party are I call them a gateway drug to fascists, because they're going to spirit in. And maybe that's the agenda. Maybe we'll break the Tory Labour Party. We'll disenfranchise people. We'll disenchant people so that they don't bother voting. There's nothing worth voting for, because let's face it, if you wait 16 years for a glimmer of hope, and you know, just to watch a huge majority squandered by Blair 2, then, you know, yeah, you're not going to bother, or the other lot are going to get in, the other lot being the fascists, you know, and maybe that's the thing, you know.
Yeah, well, maybe the amazing thing about the general election last year in 2024, July, was that every other word that was uttered by the Labour Party was change. Of course, there's been actually no change.
Yeah.
Everything is just exactly the same, if not worse.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, I think what, you know, you talking about this Labour Party being a gateway drug for fascism is quite appropriate, because you do this great dictator speech, Neil, don't you?
That's right, yeah. And I've actually learned it. Yeah, pleased to have learned it. I've drilled it and often walked down the street doing it, and over and over and over and over again. So hopefully I won't lose my way.
Actually, Charlie Chaplin's film The Great Dictator, was that actually out before World War II? Because it was pretty amazing, wasn't it?
I think it was inceptualized around about 39, and I think it came out in 1940. Hitler apparently saw it twice, because they were born the same month of the same year, those two.
Yeah, and remember, of course, you know, it was made in Hollywood, which the Americans at that point were not in the war, so it must have played quite an important part in, you know, in galvanizing American public opinion too.
Yeah, definitely. Although Chaplin's, you know, he said, because it's lampooning fascists or Hitler, you know, he, without, in the hindsight, without knowing the absolute homicidal lunacy and cruelty of the Nazis, he said that he would, there's no way that he would try to get a laugh out of that situation, you know. Hitler apparently saw it twice in his Bavarian mountain retreat. No one knows what he thought of it, but I always said this about, you know, when I've dressed up as the Great Dictator, but it's like, the other day this policeman came up to me and he said, look, considering everything that's happening at the moment, I think it's a bit inappropriate of you to dress like that at the moment, right in front of this Al Jazeera woman who piped up and said, don't you know who this is Adenoid Heinkel, the Great Dictator. And this cop had obviously never heard of the film. He just thought that Hitler's turned up at this pro-Palestinian kind of march or demo, and she had a tune about the film, and he had to go away because he obviously wanted to nick me for breach of the peace, dressed up as a Nazi. And Yeah, and he came back. She's always spoken to a colleague, and the colleague probably knew the film reference. I will say, just Google it, mate. You want to know what, you know, just Google The Great Dictator.
Yeah. Yeah. So the police don't necessarily know anything about The Great Dictator, but actually Neil did in the longer interview, he's done the speech that he's done a sort of version of The Great Dictator speech up to date with things like the internet involved in it, which is, I think, a super job. Anyway, Neil, I think one of the superstar activists, and filmmakers, and I'll put a link up to his channel where he's got loads of stuff. He's put a whole load of archive stuff up on there recently from the 1980s, from the battles between the Thatcher government and the peace convoy, which was going around to US bases, which were trying to bring in those cruise missiles back in the 1980s, etc. And lots of stuff that Neil's done over the years, other activist documentaries. And of course, he's saying that this is the bet. Well, this is the best, one of the best forms of therapy. Rather than getting depressed by these horrific fascistic type changes, like, let's just leave the disabled people to die or rot or try and compete for a job. And Arbeit macht frei is what they're saying. Come on, get a job. And maybe we'll put you in a little concentration camp and give you a job in there. And you can work for BMW. You know, making indicator sticks or something, and then we'll let you out maybe after a few years. But this is the way that the passage of politics seems to be going, which he points out there, Matt.
Yeah, that's beautiful and resonates strongly with what my experiences are with activism. Of course, you encounter many frustrating breakdowns and defeats along the way, but you have these moments where you're just like, thank goodness I decided to go out and do this today. I feel awesome. I'm connecting with a wonderful other people that are doing something, and you realize you are empowered to do things, and you do have huge successes along the way that surprise you. I went to the protest outside Royal Courts of Justice in London last Friday, and you know, I was sort of a bit overwhelmed going there, it was a bit scary what's happening, but also had a lot going on in my, you know, meeting some family and these other plans and music stuff, and I was like, am I really going to get up at 5 in the morning to get on the bus and go? And I, you know, I sort of pushed myself to do it, because I was like, this is important. You know, this is non-violent act of, you know, direct action being prescribed as terrorism. This is outrageous. All right. So I do it. And when I got there, my goodness, just the energy of the people outside, beautiful, resistance. It just made me feel energized. You know, you kind of think, oh, it's a drag, we can't do anything, I'm going to feel power. No, the opposite. You know, I just felt so energized and inspired being there. And that's why people often say, oh, protests don't do anything. They do. They do put a little pressure. But what I think they do even more than that, perhaps, is that it galvanizes you, it energizes you, and it forms networks. You know, you meet people there that you form networks with, you know, that leads to other things. You know, you work together, you give each other ideas. Craig Murray walked out of the court just as I was there, and so I had a good chat to him.
Well, he was right inside, wasn't he? He was actually doing the definitive report on the case.
Yes, he's done a good report. Yeah. He was monitoring it. And so, you know, I know him through the Assange stuff, and then I went to work with him in Blackburn, and when he ran there. And so he gave me a bit of, you know, we had a chat, and like I say, I organized some things with him. I talked to him about a Freed Assange exhibition event that we're doing, and you know, he said he'd like to take part. And then the same thing with Matt Kennard. So like I say, you know, it's a place to network and go on and do other things, so that protests do happen.
Get arrested.
This is a place to get arrested. New strategy. So.
Neil's there is talking about a direct action thing outside Downing Street, which people did get arrested. But he did, I mean, I put this to him. I said, well, look, you know, what about when you get arrested? This is all very well. A lot of people don't want to do this because, you know, they don't want to go to a police cell. Mm. And he had some advice for anyone that does find themselves that, is to get, you know, get a little card, stick it in your pocket with a certain phone number.
What saved me, because I was on trial a couple of times last year, and what actually saved, because I wasn't sleeping, you know, you're kind of worried about, I don't know, people breaking the door down. One of my prized possessions is a penny black, and you kind of like lying awake at night, you know, thinking that the bailiffs are going to turn up and smash a door down and nick your stamp collection. And just, but the, I spoke to Green and Black legal people. They're just amazing. It, you know, if you, they really calm the nerves legal wise. And you know, give you that kind of almost instant, reassurance about certain things. Now, mate, you're not going to get a £10,000 fine. You know, it's, you know, it's a certain kind of case and you're looking at maybe a couple of hundred quid. So you start to sleep at night, you know, and you don't have to wait around for, I don't know, weeks to speak to someone at Byman's who are probably too busy because they've got a million Just Stop Oil people to deal with. You can speak to them straight away. So it's Green and Black. That's a really good tip to get some legal advice. And if you can in any way, chuck a couple of quid their way because they do an amazing job. And they fill that gap, that void, that legal void where, you know, you might have to wait weeks to speak to someone. They'll just sort you out that afternoon. They'll phone you back.
So Matt, what's your experience of being arrested and the whole process after that and doing legal, you know, trying to make sure that you've got someone there who's prepared to, so for example, you could apply, you could try and contact a group like Amnesty or, National Campaign for Civil Liberties, now called Liberty, but they've got a massive caseload, and the idea of, you know, getting you a barrister to represent you is not going to necessarily happen. But anyway, so what's your experience?
There is. So the wonderful thing is, like, these networks of activists, they know the game and they support you. So generally you go to these events and people will hand out these what they call arrest cards. And it's a little business card with phone numbers of great legal organizations that will support you, you know, without charge, because they are, you know, ethically doing this for the cause. And there's HJA, that's who I rung when I was arrested for the January 18 protest that was supposed to go to the BBC, and we weren't allowed to to protest outside our public broadcaster against their bias towards a genocide, which is very interesting. That case is ongoing, but has been postponed because the courts are overwhelmed, which is also an important part of all of this. You know, which sort of, why would you want to get arrested? I mean, I didn't want to get arrested on that day. I didn't expect to, but I was. But there is a strategy now for the, which came out of the Just Stop Oil actions, and this group Defend Our Juries are now helping with the case of Palestine Action to highlight the ridiculousness of the law prescribing them, because they're so well supported, really. And that was clear when I went out this week wearing a sign saying that I support Palestine Action. There was so much love and support from the public. So this idea that we're going to censor ourselves, you're not allowed to say that you support them if you do, is preposterous. And it's an attack on free speech as well as direct, you know, nonviolent protest. They're upholding the law, you know, because we have a legal duty to take steps to prevent genocide. They're actually the gold standard of the law, whereas the UK government is supplying weapons for it. So we can't sit back, I don't think, and just allow them to do this, allow them to intimidate us. So the strategy is that Defend Our Juries is helping organize, they're doing these, they did one in London, on last weekend where they had, I think about 90 people, sitting there and holding a sign, just very peaceful, sitting down, not speaking, holding a sign saying, I am against genocide and I support Palestine Action. And so there were a large number of arrests. But the thing is that the prison system here in the UK is at capacity. There's only about 963 cells available, according to Sky News. Even the UK government's own website is talking about a crisis. And that's all across the UK. And remember, those cells are not only designed, hopefully, for peaceful protesters. There's other crimes going on that they may need them for. So I think it's very easy to point out how ridiculous this is, but also put so much pressure on the police that they have to go back to the government and say, look, please stop this. Deprescribe this group because we can't enforce it. So that's our strategy. So, right. Yeah, I encourage people to... a bit of civil disobedience. If you genuinely support them, this is my view, not the view of the show or anything, anyone else, but my view is that if you genuinely support Palestine Action, say it, but be mindful that you could be arrested, all the rest of it. But we've seen from what happened on the weekend that they, even the organizer was only arrested under the very lesser law. Doesn't mean he couldn't be charged later, which one that goes up to 14 years. So when I broke that law, that was what I was thinking. I could be facing 14 years, but I was like, damn, I'm not going to silence myself. Cause I believe this. I'm not going to do that. So, but it seems that they're in the lesser scale, that they were only arrested under the section that has a maximum of 6 months, and you could have a suspended sentence if you don't have any priors, and they may not charge anybody. They haven't charged anyone yet. So the plan is to do this every week, and each week to make it bigger and bigger. So 100 the first week. Now there's going to be 3 cities this weekend. London, I can't remember the other two off the top of my head, but then there's talk of doing Bristol next, so just getting more and more.
In the old days, everyone used to go to the Palestine Action Twitter account or website. That they closed their Twitter account last Friday, saying, well, look, you know, there's too much information on here about Palestine activists, photographs and all that sort of thing. Although, of course, the authorities probably got records of all of that, so it's a shame they closed that in a way.
I agree.
And also, they've made it clear, the courts, that being a supporter of Palestine Action last year or last week even is not a crime.
It
becomes a crime at a certain point in time. So I'm not quite sure about that PA decision. Anyway, you talking about juries, right? This week, jury-free trials have been proposed to save the criminal justice system from collapse. A senior judge, Sir Brian Leveson, who you might remember for his appalling press inquiry a few years ago, unveils radical proposals to clear a huge backlog in the Crown Courts in England and Wales. So there's been a big backlog because of the austerity cuts and cuts to the court services. But they're saying the solution is to just forget paying juries and it's too expensive.
I see what they're doing there. So the Defend Our Juries group was coming out of Just Stop Oil, but it was also specifically around a protest that a woman did, a solo woman, just coming back to the point of what can we do? Everyone can do something, you know, and she stood outside the court during these Just Stop Oil prosecutions, and she said she put something on a sign that was actually printed inside the courtrooms that the exact phrase I can't recall, but it's about the jury can use their conscience. That these trials were attempting to insist that the juries are not allowed to hear the reasons why these activists have done what they've done, doing the civil disobedience, breaking into things, causing property damage, but in order to do what? Well, in order to try to, you know, stop climate change and all the rest. So the judges have been trying to insist that the people being prosecuted couldn't tell the jury why they did what they did. And, that's an affront to, the jury should be allowed to do that. So she was
in a crime. She was arrested. Just a minute, a motive is quite important in any crime. If they're saying this is why I've done it, I mean, that's a motive. And so if you're not interested in that, you're not interested in actually justice at all.
That's right. And so these cases are just being presented as a criminal thing. And the jury wasn't. And this idea of public interest, it also comes back to Assange case. You know, the Espionage Act used against Assange, Snowden and Manning. The key reason why it's terrible, there are a few, but the key one is that it bans a public interest defense, meaning that, you know, and you'd get people in the street when we protest, you know, coming up to you occasionally going, well, why doesn't he just go and face justice if he's done nothing wrong? I mean, that seems reasonable on the surface. Of course, it's reasonable to have an opinion. Why didn't he? Because, and Snowden has said this too, that he will do that. He will face a jury of his peers if he's allowed to say why he did it and let them decide if he did the right thing or not, but he's not. So under the Espionage Act, you are explicitly prohibited from telling the jury why you did what you did, because it was designed to stop actual spies, and they didn't want, you know, that kind of makes sense. You don't want the jury to then be hearing these state secrets and going, you know, if they genuinely are a risk to the empire or to the security of the, not to the empire, but to security.
Well, it seems
of the country.
To me that, look, the biggest threat to national security is the government.
Yeah, that's right. And these, you know, colonial
hence
invasions.
It's almost like normal. It's like, I love what Neil said. And by the way, folks, Neil Goodwin, the longer interview with him I'll put up on our show page in case you missed it, because of the dropouts earlier on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Absolutely fascinating insight into the psychology of a filmmaker, radical filmmaker turned disabled activist, who knows the ropes. He's been around this 1,000 times, far more than the police know. And so it's fascinating to hear, I think, what Neil had to say. On this whole business of the proscribing of Palestine action, though, what was your take home? Because you were up there last Friday, weren't you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, the support, there was so much support outside the court. It was great energy. As I say, I felt energized by that. And I just think the court, the police and the courts will not be able to handle it. This is the thing. It's like if what their goal is to intimidate and to get us to stop speaking up and to that show, you know, Assange said, and censorship shows fear. You really want to focus in on what they're trying to stop, because it's what they're afraid of that can stop them. So Palestine Action, we're doing things that were actually really genuinely...
Well, that's right. There's several factories producing arms were closed down. Yeah. Lots of businesses that were doing dealings with Elbit Systems, the Israeli arms manufacturer, they were persuaded to stop doing business with them.
That's right.
And many of them, in fact, didn't even know that they were involved in... Yeah, the genocide. It's been a very effective way of sending a financial message. You know, I can remember back I was working in London as a researcher during the 1990s, during the IRA's London bombing campaign, and they were blowing up very, very big truck bombs all around the city of London. Was it Bishopsgate, I think? Was Canary Wharf? There were three massive bombs. And Baltic Wharf was the other one. And eventually, they bombed their way. They gave warnings. They gave telephoned code word warnings through to, I think it was to Broadcasting House, actually, saying there's a bomb going to go off in half an hour here. Get everyone out. And so hardly anyone was killed in any of these attacks. But there was hundreds of millions of pounds worth of damage done each time.
Wow.
So in a way, they're doing to Elbit is similar to the IRA that actually brought peace to Northern Ireland. By doing this non-violent action, whether it's blowing up a massive office block or a street in the central London, or where it's disabling an arms factory, this seems to be actually the way forward.
Yeah, that's right. And it is non-violent. You know, people grapple with this, is it? Because it's like it's causing damage to property. But property, that's not violence. You know, they're not harming any people. And their goal is to stop people
being harmed. Well, the Terrorism Act doesn't agree with you. The Terrorism Act does say that property, it includes property in the definition of terrorism, which, I mean, some people would disagree with that, but that's actually what the law says.
Yes,
anyway, look, so we've had Mark Rowley, Mark Rowley, the Metropolitan Chief Constable, speaking on the Laura Koonsberg show, talking firstly about centralising power, as the Freemasons always, no, I'm not saying he's a Freemason, I'm sure he's not a Freemason, which is one of the things they always do, like, we want to get rid of all these different police, what are they called? You know, the areas like the Avon and Somerset Police, the various different constabularies, and have them as much few, like only about one third of them. So they want a centralised power. What that tells you is there's not enough crooks, the top cops, to run the whole thing. So there's quite a few chief constables out there are actually human beings. Maybe they would like to replace them with AI or something. Yeah. But the idea that the policing in this country is decentralised, very powerful and very important for support of the community. So let's have a listen to Mark Rowley.
Let's just briefly have a word about that protest yesterday. We saw some of the images from it this morning, including an 83-year-old female priest being taken away from a demonstration, having been holding a placard. Is that really a good use of police time?
The law doesn't have an age limit. Whether you're 18 or 80, if you're supporting prescribed organisations, then the law's going to be enforced. Officers, you could see, did it with great care. and try to preserve that person's dignity, but they're breaking a serious law. Palestine Action have, over the last 18 months, have to be careful what I say because there's cases coming to trial, but some really serious criminal offences that they're accused of. There are millions of pounds worth of damage on multiple occasions. There are assaults. There are weapons used. This is not about protest. This is about an organisation committing serious criminality, and obviously the Home Secretary was persuaded by the papers on her desk to prescribe them. That law's coming to force, and if people want to defy that law, then we have to enforce it.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming months with those cases that are going to court.
Yeah, so assaults and weapons used. Yeah, so he's basically, potentially rupturing the Crown's case there by alleging something that is not true. Palestine Action did not cause any assaults. That's so that could be why. Some of the case that's ongoing about January 18 has just been postponed a year, and I've heard rumour perhaps that some of these statements that are being made, including that they're being funded by Iran, you know, which there's no evidence for at all, are jeopardising the case.
We heard from Nick Georges last week that his case has been put off another 18 months. Well, he's already been waiting nearly 3 years, 2.5 years.
Yeah.
This is the Shenstone case where they went up onto a roof and smashed some windows, apparently, of a Elbit factory, which caused a lot of consternation. Quite a lot of rain comes in and this sort of thing. What the government have been doing by making these false allegations, like funding from Iran, this kind of thing, is the judges are recognising, well, this is prejudicing this case. In fact, it's contempt of court. That is in itself a criminal offence.
Yeah, it's incredible that Mark Rowley there, the chief police of the Met, said, before he said all that, he said, I have to be careful what I say. And then he said that. He made a false allegation. It's incredible. So they're not perhaps as bright as you might.
Or maybe
like
they're doing
think.
It on purpose. I suppose they're saying they're trying to cover themselves. I don't know if his own detectives and officers are going to arrest him for contempt of court.
Yeah. Well, I actually tagged the Met Police in my story on Instagram, saying that in them showing that clip and saying he can't say that. And they do. They always check my stories when I tag them because you get a little scene notification. So I was like, good. Glad they got that message. But as you say, the court's overrun, the prison's overrun, so it's not actually hard for us to use our power as, you know, people to put too much pressure on them. So that this happened with Just Stop Oil, I understand. I've been told that the same strategy, Defend Our Juries, did this, and, getting people to intentionally get arrested, break the law, until the police actually go to them and say, look, we cannot enforce this. It becomes untenable. So that is a strategy.
Well, that's the same strategy. It would be like, we're going to, burgle shops until the police say, well, we can't stop this anymore.
Well, I don't think you got enough support for that. Most people know that burgling shop is not right. They don't want to do that. So I think but the opposite for Palestine Action. People recognize the morality of what they're doing. When I went out wearing my sign, it was just I got so much love and support from different members of the community. I went from feeling very anxious going out to, suddenly I saw this mural. I put it in my bag for a second. I was like, maybe I wait till I get to my destination. And then I'm in Stokescroft driving past Turbo Island, and I saw this huge, huge mural saying, we are all Palestine Action. And I went, oh, wow. And I immediately took it back out of my bag, popped it on. And throughout the day, I just got so much heartfelt love and support.
Well, it's nice to know, isn't it? But we haven't actually heard a lot from Palestine Action activists themselves and from the organisers. But that's probably because of our useless mainstream press. I was just hearing today, by the way, from Friends, Families and Travellers, which is a traveller support group in Brighton, that Bristol Radio, rather than calling the activists here in Bristol and the homeless activists in Bristol, they phoned them in Brighton to find out what's going on here in Bristol. So I said, well, it's okay, you can pass our number on, But of course, the way they work is, we're going to go through some system and, we don't want to talk to these people in Stokescroft, blah, blah, whoever. So they are useless, the mainstream press. They just don't have the contacts. They don't even seem to want to have the contacts. But you know who does? Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera speaks to Palestine Action because they're reporting them correctly. Palestine Action, trust them. And if you don't trust the journalists, you're not going to talk to them. So that's what Palestine Action, I guess, are up to here. So let's have a listen to the name of the guy. I think is it P.A. Hill or something? I'm not sure of his name, but anyway, I'll tell you afterwards. And in fact, she might even introduce him.
My name's Hill Akid. I'm an author and an organiser based in London, UK. There's a long history of direct action, which I think inspired Palestine Action, including Palestine focused sort of decommissioning of military sites such as the Raytheon 9 and Smash Edo, but also other sort of foreign policy issues and wars, such as the women who decommissioned the Hawk jets that were going to be used by Suharto's regime in Indonesia to bomb East Timor. And also more recent history in this country, there's been an uptick in direct action around the climate emergency. So one of the founders of Palestine Action, Richard Barnard, was, I think, involved in a group called Extinction Rebellion, who used mass civil disobedience tactics, as other groups have used, such as Just Stop Oil, because they felt that the state was acting far too slowly, and they used direct action for this reason. None of them have been branded terrorists, although there has been, again, this is the broader context, increasing repression of direct action tactics, such as the criminalization of the use of quote-unquote lock-ons. And so this is, I think, and for me, an illustration of the problems with the war on terror as a whole, is that it has been used by states around the world, not just in Britain, to increase state control and to minimize people's freedoms to protest.
More with Hill after the break. So, Hill, one really interesting point here and sort of concerning, you might say, Palestine Action now joins 81 other groups in the UK that are, quote, prescribed under the Terrorism Act of 2000. These groups include ISIL, they include Al-Qaeda, Hamas. I think there's at least one neo-Nazi group in the mix there.
That's good to know, because the Order of the Nine Angles, which is a terrorist group, Yvette Cooper, it is a satanic Nazi terrorist group, not a neo-Nazi group. You haven't banned that, have you? But you're banning a bunch of Quakers who support Palestine. Something very sick is going on in the Home Office.
Oh, it's such a hypocrisy. So the very day that they prescribed Palestine Action, July the 5th, David Lammy, UK Foreign
Secretary,
was meeting with, Al-Ashad, who was former Al-Qaeda, then created HTS, which is ostensibly, you know, an Al-Qaeda cutout. Currently, they are still proscribed in the UK as a terrorist organization. Now, he allegedly stepped down from them in January when he was put in charge of Syria. But the HTS is apparently still very much the organization that is behind that proxy puppet government. Sorry. I mean, totally legitimate government. And yet there was David Lammy on the same day shaking his hand and offering him, what was it, the exact figure? It was some large figure of our taxpayer dollars. I don't want to say the figure in case I can't remember off the top of my head. But there we go. So he was literally paying a currently prescribed terrorist organization while they were prescribing, same day they were prescribing Palestine Action, a non-violent protest group.
Well, they're getting themselves in their, or should we say, their knickers in a twist, I think. They're trying very hard to hold two totally opposite thoughts in their heads at the same time.
Yeah.
Obviously not very well organized. Not surprising. I will, by the way, folks, I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk that wonderful graph of the Starmer Labour Party approval rating, which is just, it's like going off a cliff, really. And it's like they don't care. But someone that does care is a chap called Loki. He's been digging into whether it was actually the Home Office and Yvette Cooper that proscribed Palestine Action, or maybe somebody from the Israeli embassy and people who are being paid by Israel.
We Believe in Israel has even boasted about being given access to classified police information from a counter-terror investigation into Palestine Action in 2022. Why would a lobby group for a foreign power not only be so deeply involved in the security state of this country, but why would it have access to classified documents? We Believe in Israel came out of BICOM, Israel's largest lobby group in Britain, which is currently led by Richard Pater, a reserve in the Israeli military who previously was employed by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. We Believe in Israel campaigned to remove my music from Spotify. At the time, it was led by Luke Akehurst, now serving as a Labour MP. Here is Israeli political officer from the embassy discussing Luke Akehurst and We Believe in Israel.
So Luke Akehurst is the director of We Believe in Israel. He's a great guy.
He's one of the best to be inside.
Why are we allowing a foreign lobby group led by an alleged spy to dictate what is and isn't acceptable protest in this country? What about the other lobbying? Footage has recently emerged of Board of Deputies officials admitting that they have lobbied the Home Office on the issue of Palestine Action.
We had a meeting with Dan Jarvis, the security minister, this week. The whole conversation was around, first of all, how they have stepped up already in terms of something that is not quite the same as prescription, and we're trying to understand exactly what that means, and they're looking at more organisations to which that could apply. In addition to that, he said they are looking to take further action on Palestine Action, and he hasn't described what that would be, but that's in the pipeline.
Of course, the Board of Deputies admitted in its own internal documents, its trustees report, that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy and strengthened links to the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the IDF spokesman's unit. Another key figure in the drive to label Palestine Action as a terrorist organization is none other than Jonathan Woodcock, now known as Lord Walney. While serving as a Labour MP, Woodcock was accused of sexual harassment. He resigned from the Labour Party. He was seemingly later rewarded with a seat in the House of Lords.
So help me God.
Following the appointment of Lord Walney as the government's independent protest advisor, he suggested the prescription of Palestine Action as a terrorist organization. Woodcock was previously chair of the Labour Friends of Israel lobby group. Woodcock has accepted funding and hospitality from the European Leadership Network. The European Leadership Network is included on a list of organizations controlled directly by the Israeli Ministry of Diaspora Affairs, and was revealed to be one of the organizations involved in the Voices of Israel project, ran directly by the Israeli government.
So impressed with what Elnet is doing, bringing people together from across the European continent.
In addition to that, Walney chaired the Purpose Defence Coalition.
The Defence Coalition is made up of the UK's most innovative leaders and businesses in the defence sector.
A lobby group which included the arms company Leonardo, one of the targets of Palestine Action.
John, can I just ask you whether you're the right person to be advancing these arguments, given that you're a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel and Palestine Action? They say you're part of the current chair of the Defence Purpose Coalition, and you're getting funding from the Israel lobby.
I think when any organisation starts talking about an Israel lobby, they need to look at their own slide into anti-Semitism.
But as a perception, John, I mean, you are the former chair of Labour Friends of Israel.
Mm.
Do you not see that, how this is going to come across?
It's also now known that Yvette Cooper, the minister responsible for prescribing Palestine Action, has received funding from Israel lobbyists. And Keir Starmer is somebody who has been handsomely funded by Israel lobbyists. Keir Starmer is a supposed human rights lawyer who has previously acted on behalf of those accused of taking direct action to stop war crimes. He's gone from supporting those taking direction to stop war crimes to supporting those carrying out war crimes and criminalising and terrorising those who have a conscience.
Well, so the BBC aren't doing it, but Loki is. Double Down News, I think that was on. But he's doing the crunching the numbers, Matt. And he's finding all sorts of financial brown envelopes.
Yeah, and this is key. You know, I did some research when I went out to break the law into what the legal implications could be. And, you know, found that, of course, it's a selective prosecution because there they are, David Lammy. It was £94.5 million he promised to, Al-Ashad on that same day, the terrorist organization. So I was like, well, this is clearly selective. So selective prosecution.
Can't he split that with Palestine Action? I mean, give them maybe £47 million each.
That would be lovely. That would be fair. But apparently, like selective prosecution isn't always enough grounds to overturn a proscription. Apparently it's quite hard to do. But what is solid grounds is bad faith. If you can show, as Loki has just nicely done, that there is actually lobbying going on behalf of this group over that group, and so there's a conflict of interest there. So clearly there is, and so that's why I think the legal basis, you know, you asked that question earlier, why don't we start a campaign to just go out doing robberies? Well, because that just stands as a crime. Anyone who does that will not be able to appeal that, but the prescription of Palestine Action should be able to be because of these facts and because of the fact that they are actually, Palestine Action are actually upholding international law by taking steps to prevent a genocide. We have a legal obligation to do that. And as well as it's an attack on free speech, and that is why I am also speaking up against it. I will not censor myself. I thought about it for a moment, holding my tongue, and then my stomach turned. I thought, yeah.
It's not you. Let me just inform you. It's not you. But anyhow, so you were at, we mentioned Craig Murray earlier on. He was the man in the courtroom. He did a very long report on his blog at the weekend, or maybe early this week, about that court case. Let's have a listen to him speaking to Crispin Flintoff, who, by the way, is a sort of sister show to this. Crispin does his program at the weekends. I think it's on a Sunday morning. Instead of listening to Laura Klugelsberg, you can have a listen to Crispin. Much more interesting. And they're doing, so Loki, by the way, Loki will have the full version of that full investigation into the Luke Akehurst and various other characters taking money from Israel, forcing proscription of Palestine Action through last week, and of course Yvette Cooper just bending over and doing her thing and just ticking the box. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the man who was actually in the courtroom as there was an appeal to stay the execution of the proscribing of Palestine Action last Friday in the Royal Courts of Justice.
You can argue for the deproscription of Palestine Action. You could argue that Palestine Action should not be a prescribed organisation, provided in making the argument you don't say anything that indicates you support the organisation. Now, that's an extremely strange legal conundrum to be in. And, of course, the great difficulty is, and the judge has said that. The judge has said, this does not prevent people from arguing that. And the lawyers for Palestine Action said, but it does mean that. It does mean you can't, you know, in practice, it stops people arguing against the prescription or arguing for deeper prescription. And the judges refused to see that. And of course, the difficulty is that the law is not being interpreted in the first instance by a high court judge. The law is being interpreted in the first instance by a policeman, possibly a policeman of quite limited legal education. And so the niceties of what you ought to be able to do and what you ought not to be able to do, and what eventually a senior court judgment may decide if you were right or wrong, but you could have spent months of your life on remand in jail reaching that point of judgment. So the capacity where they only have to act on suspicion that you may be supporting or that you may be appearing to support the ability to discuss anything much without getting arrested by a policeman is actually quite small. Well, one thing I definitely can tell you, and I think people need to be very aware of this, there was a moment in the trial, which I think was in the afternoon after we spoke there, when the lawyer for the government stated, we do not deny that it is draconian, it is meant to be. And that was a direct quote. We do not deny that it is draconian, it is meant to be. And so that kind of affirmation of the deliberate crushing power of the state was quite chilling to hear in court.
Yeah. You can talk about the Terrorism Act that sort of preceded that, the prescriptions, because someone was putting on Twitter a thread about Jack Straw's assurances at the time of that debate in Parliament and for the Terrorism Act. It sort of worries me that an Act of Parliament can be brought in with all these assurances, and then certain things are kind of adapted and changed. And what's your memory of that debate that where this all came into place, this Terrorism Act and this support, this idea of supporting? I mean, how on earth is that passed through when it's so? It's so vague that, you know, we're all scared.
Yeah, no, it's extremely difficult, and it's intended, as the government said, it's intended to be draconian. The intent is that we should be all scared. But one thing I want to get over to people, I think, is, you know, this is a desperate act. It makes the government look extremely stupid. It makes the government look illiberal. But there's a handful, there's like 15% of the population who are dyed-in-the-wool racists who love Israel and are happy to see Palestinians killed, largely because they are under a mistaken misapprehension that most Palestinians are Muslims and they hate Muslims. There's a small percentage of the population who hold those. They are cheering, including Israel. But the vast majority of people are horrified by this, you know, are horrified by aged priests being arrested, are horrified by the attack on freedom of speech. And the vast majority of people are horrified by the genocide in Gaza. And this panic move, this is a sign of weakness by the state. This is not a sign of strength by the state. This is a sign that the politicians have lost control of the narrative to the people and are scared of the people. That's why they are doing this. That's why they are obsessing with what musicians say at a pop concert, as though that were a great threat to the state. You know, we are winning and they are terrified when it comes to the domestic political situation. And I think that's a key thing I want people to think of.
Yeah, so that's Craig Murray explaining in some detail what was going on in the court there, Matt. And also, yeah, you got a photo of him as he came out, didn't you?
It was a beautiful moment. You know, it's always a pleasure to see him. He does fantastic work, did great work with Assange. And I got to work with him in Blackburn. That was all just as Assange was about to be released. He was actually talking to me about it and asking about my thoughts on it without me realizing that was fully in play and he was talking to the inside group. I didn't realize. But no, he's great. He actually outlined the case of how to take Israel to the ICJ, which was then taken up by South Africa, and the South African lawyers actually had his outline with them.
Good.
In court.
Well, I mean, yeah, he's a former ambassador. I remember him saying he was at the Foreign Office, he was head of maritime law, which is quite an important thing for the British Foreign Office, at least it was 100 years ago. So he does know his legal stuff, and although it can be a bit boring sometimes, he's very good at pulling apart the most important aspects, and he's a kind of legal advisor. I don't know if he's a kind of McKenzie friend or something, but anyway,
what's that?
The McKenzie friends are people who will go in and they're not lawyers, but they will be allowed in court there to support you.
All right. Yeah, he goes in and observes and reports. I mean, he's kind of like a journalist now.
He's more of a journalist, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he also was a whistleblower. So when he was ambassador, and a UK ambassador, he blew the whistle on some CIA operations, and then, you know, that's what sort of radicalized him. And he gave up a very cushy life. You know, he talks about it. He had servants upon servants, and he gave all of that up to speak the truth. So the man's got integrity. And, you know, I saw him sleeping out, picture him sleeping outside the ICJ in the winter. So it's sort of like, yeah, he doesn't have to prove anything to anyone at this point. So follow him. He's a good one.
He is. Another good one is, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say his point about it revealing fear. All these things, these are desperate moves. We do have to push back on them because they're dangerous if we let them get away with it. But it does highlight fear. You know, Julian Assange said censorship reveals fear. So all of those things that they're pushing back on, those are things that we should continue, not stop. You know, in the US, Trump is talking about, oh, I'm not afraid of de-dollarization. No. You know, yes, they are. And also in the US, they have worked to criminalize sanctioning Israel. Again, that is something to continue to do. So whatever they point at, continue doing it.
They're revealing their own weaknesses, aren't they, a lot of the time?
Exactly. Yeah, it's when it, you know, when you're having an argument with someone and you push the button, and you know that's the tender point you should.
Well, I do that with Martin from time to time, especially when I mention Brexit. Yeah, he doesn't like that. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to someone else who's been doing loads of stuff around Palestine, etc., who's also had this to say about the amazing, crazy, like alternative planet world of banning non-violent direct action in support of people who are stopping genocide, against genocide. So that is, I mean, it's one of the maddest things surely that's ever happened in Britain, in British law, in history. But Roger Waters, the singer from Pink Floyd, he's also been making statements about this week.
It's July the 5th, 2025. I'm in my little studio. So this is, says, Roger Waters supports Palestine action, 5th of July, 2025. Parliament has been corrupted by agents of a genocidal foreign power. Stand up and be counted. It's now. I didn't have space for or never, but it's now. That's enough. All right. I'm just going to switch back. It's now. This is the moment. I am Spartacus. Okay, this is Independence Day, July the 5th, 2025. I declare my independence from the government of the UK, who've just designated Palestine Action a terrorist, proscribed terrorist organization. For the record, 5th of July, I support Palestine Action. It's a great organization. They are non-violent. They are absolutely not terrorist in any way. They are a non-violent protest organization protesting the presence in the UK of Elbit Systems, who are an Israeli arms manufacturing organization. All right. So that's that. I support Palestine Action, and I always will, because that is the right thing to do. So following, I saw George Monbiot, the journalist, said yesterday, this is the I am Spartacus moment. I am Spartacus. So good on you, George, and good on everybody who is standing up everywhere and saying, I am Spartacus. We will not be rolled over by this appalling Labour government in the United Kingdom. Palestine Action is not a terrorist organisation. So they are lying, and they have put their lies into the law of the land. So there we are. That's all I have to say. Independence, independence, okay? We must support our brothers and sisters in Palestine and support them no matter what. So good on you. What was your name? Villain. Good on you, villain. And the rest of you who are standing up to be counted, I love you. I love you.
Bye. So There's Roger Waters, an original member of Pink Floyd. By the way, Dave Gilmour, the interloper who appeared after the departure of Syd Barrett, for those Pink Floyd aficionados who remember these things.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He wasn't even in the original one.
No, mate.
Really?
Dave Gilmour is saying, oh, Roger Waters is crazy, man. He's completely loose. Yeah. But you were not part of original Pink Floyd. Syd was amazing. I mean, you know, the original Pink Floyd was a very interesting late 1960s band. It transmogrified after Syd. Syd kind of lost it and left the band and went on to become a gardener, I think.
Yeah.
But he'd had too many drugs.
He did, a little bit too much tea. But Roger certainly was, yeah, it came as a conversation between Roger and Syd on a train. They discussed it. So they were the two founding members. But Roger has definitely been outspoken and is so well informed. You can follow him on any issue. He's always up with the play. He was very, very vocal on Assange case. So love him a lot. I mean, I loved him as from a musical point of view and you know, the innovative with the visuals and things. They were using projections. You know, now every group and every act uses projections. The Pink Floyd were pioneers of that. So he's always been in the cutting edge, very bright man. So I got, and it was, yeah, I saw that. I was already thinking, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to speak up myself. But when I saw him do that, it really gave me confidence and strength.
So you're channeling Pink Floyd.
Well, yeah, Roger Waters. I saw that clip, and that's what I hadn't put. I was quite busy, but I was also certainly thinking over: am I going to do this? When I saw that, I was like, okay, no more decision. I'm doing it. I'm posting it right now. Posted the clip of myself in London saying I still support Past in Action, and flipping off the camera. you know, it's the Young Spartacus thing is a beautiful analogy because what they're trying to do is to get us to be afraid and to silence ourselves. But we are many, you know, and there's that beautiful clip from the film where everyone's, you know, Spartacus is about to stand up and they're trying to get them to turn on Spartacus, but instead they all stand up and say, I'm Spartacus. And the strength in numbers, and they can't jail us all. So I think this is a powerful thing. Now, of course, everyone has to think about whether they want to take part, but I think hopefully there's enough of us, and I believe there will be, to put pressure on them. And it's like the panopticon where all they have to do is actually convince you that they can put you away, and so you start policing yourself. They don't even need to. If they can just convince you to be afraid, we police ourselves. And I think that's already, you know, that is already having that impact. People have, a lot of people have silenced themselves because they are afraid of prosecution, which is understandable. But I say, you know, there's more of us than them. Past in Action are, you know, they can be, of course, liable for criminal damage, but the idea that they're terrorists is absolute nonsense. So I don't think, personally, we should censor ourselves, and I think there's strength in numbers, and we should continue speaking up for them.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And also, I'm disgusted by the misuse of the Terrorism Act, which probably shouldn't have been put in the statute anyway. I was reminded by, this is something that came in under the Blair government, by Norman Baker. A couple of weeks ago, interviewed him, the former policing minister. He pointed out from the Lib Dems, the Lib Dem coalition, he was saying, we had been dealing with the Labour government before that, including the bringing in of the Terrorism Act, where they wanted to give the police powers to keep people in jail for a month without even charging them. Wow. And so the Labour Party are particularly bad when it comes to civil liberties. They don't really give a stuff.
Yeah.
And that was back there under the Blair government. So they were really caving in to the fascist lobby by saying, well, the police can just lock people up, you know, throw away the key for a month just to punish them.
Yeah.
And there shouldn't be any comeback. And that's part of this marvellous thing called the Terrorism Act. But why was that brought in? Because it was brought in just before 9/11. It was brought in before the 7/7 London bombings. And you would think, actually, maybe it should be brought in after these things. But no, it's almost as if somebody knew that these sorts of terrorist attacks were going to take place. And I just... like to remind people that Monday this week was the 20th anniversary of the London bombings, where 56 people died. I mean, they say on the news, they say 52, but there was four bombers that died too, and they just don't count them. They didn't die. They blew themselves up. But no. Did they really blow themselves up? No. In all likelihood, no. They were shot at Canary Wharf. In fact, it was a New Zealand journalist working for Reuters that contacted the New Zealand Herald to say, actually, I've just seen a bunch of people being shot here at Canary Wharf. There's loads of police and some people have been killed. So it looks likely as if that may have been the place where they... And that was just not reported at all on the day. There was a complete news blackout on that. And also there was no CCTV of any of the alleged bombers actually on the tube platforms or on the trains. There was loads of evidence of the bombs being underneath the trains. In other words, most of the injuries caused to the passengers on the London bombings were leg injuries. There's also Mark Honingsbaum from The Guardian, who twice in his report talked about the bombs being underneath the trains, and that was on the day he did that audio report for The Guardian, and he'd just spoken to loads of people who'd come out of, I think it was the Edgware Road tube. I did a long interview with Richie Allen on Monday about this, which was a sort of 20 years update. And you know what? It really rankled with me seeing all this misreporting of the 7/7 London bombings. Having been a journalist in London during the IRA campaign I was mentioning earlier, and then to see this false flag attack take place in London. Now, who was in London on the day? Benjamin Netanyahu, when he was finance minister. He was finance minister, yeah, and he was given a warning by the Israeli embassy. Don't go where you think you were going to go. I think he was heading off to Liverpool Street, but they told him, don't go there, because it looks like it's going to be a bomb attack.
Is that right? What's the evidence for that?
Well, the evidence is Associated Press report. Yeah. Amy Teeble from the Associated Press in Jerusalem phoned the London embassy as soon as they heard about the bombings. They told her, it's okay, Netanyahu's fine, we gave him a warning. But they didn't give a warning to Scotland Yard. So there's all sorts of very important bits of evidence here that were not really talked about. But anyway, this is how the BBC reported the... it was the main news. In fact, it was 15 minutes. It was nearly half of their 6 p.m. bulletin on Radio 4 on Monday.
52 people who died in a series of suicide bombings in central London 20 years ago today have been remembered in a service at St Paul's Cathedral. Four men blew themselves up on London Underground trains and a bus during the morning rush hour in a plot that had been inspired by Al-Qaeda. Hundreds of people were injured. The King has paid tribute to the spirit of unity shown in the aftermath, which he said had helped the nation to heal. Our home editor Mark Easton was at St Paul's and sent this report.
White petals were dropped from the whispering gallery of St. Paul's Cathedral as the names of the 52 victims of 7/7 were read out.
James Mays.
20 years on, and the shockwave from the bombs was still being felt by Saba Edwards, whose mother was among those who died on that summer morning.
Behnaz Mazako.
Today's service honoured the selfless bravery of those who ran towards danger to help strangers in distress, first responders, transport workers, people just going to work. Four suicide bombers detonated devices on the capital's transport network, three almost simultaneously on tube trains beneath King's Cross, Liverpool Street and Edgware Road at rush hour. A fourth bomb exploded an hour later on a bus. 52 people were killed in the attacks, nearly 800 injured. The fact that three of the suicide bombers had been born and raised within British Muslim communities had prompted urgent debates about radicalization, integration, and multiculturalism. There were fears 7/7 might tear the UK's diverse social fabric. But as Britain Today reflected on its impact, a constant theme was how the attacks brought the nation together. Gilly Hicks lost both her legs in the King's Cross bomb.
People risked their lives to save my life, and they gave me everything they could. And it was holding my broken body with unconditional love. You know, that's extraordinary. And so it's having that as my base of my second life to say, gosh, this is who we are. This is humanity, and I'm the living proof of what happens when humanity comes together.
Those who tried to divide us failed, Sir Keir Starmer said in a statement. And in his message to the country today, the King also reflected on what he called the spirit of unity that has helped London and our nation to heal.
So there's the first quarter or so of the BBC's extensive report on Monday. Lie after lie after lie after lie. What they seem to be doing is a squeezing, desperately squeezing at people's heartstrings, trying to say, well, of course it was blowback, because all of these various things we've been doing in other parts of the world, the nasty Muslims, that Hitler would call Jews, but now it's Muslims, are doing all these terrible things. And actually, if you look into what actually happened on the 7/7 itself, that you'll find that there are massive great holes in the, not least of which is the train that the so-called bombers were supposed to get from Luton into central London. Was found a few days later. It didn't even run that day. So they basically sat down and put a paper consultation together to say these things. So anyway, I'm sorry to drop this on you, but is this news to you, Matt, some of this? Now, obviously, the Netanyahu business is.
I mean, I've heard a little bit you speak on this, or perhaps Martin, and I've never researched this incident myself. And, I always take things with a grain of salt until I've looked into them and seen where it's coming from. And then I was being open-minded about it too. But these sorts of things start to become more, I don't know about credible, but certainly like more inclined to look into with all that's going on. And I saw this week John Kiriakou, the former CIA whistleblower, himself spoke of the same sort of about turn on 9/11. He said that someone asked him, are you now more willing to look at that as a potential inside, potential false flag, perhaps conducted by another state like Israel? And he said he was. He said that he didn't used to, but he's now more inclined to. And I would say the same. Yeah, I mean, there are things like the dancing Israelis, all of those things, and you start to see that now.
They got a warning, didn't they? They were sitting there ready to film the thing when it happened.
Yeah,
it's funny, the Israelis always seem to know these things were about to happen.
And I'm not necessarily of the strict narrative that Israel is controlling the US. It's much more of a messy relationship. In fact, I believe that it's really big power interests that are largely US-based. I mean, the US is the one giving the money. Of course, there's this sort of back and forward relationship, but I don't like to simply say the narrative that, oh, Israel's controlling the US. It kind of disgusts me, because no, like the US and it was the US, it's an Anglo-US project. The Israel is the puppet, the doing their bidding, you know, and they're pretending, it's terrible what's happening, we must get a ceasefire, you know, these mealy-mouthed words. When really it's like, they're doing exactly what
they
want.
The concept of the false flag attack, since you're here from Kiwiland, you had a Christchurch mosque massacre as well, which had all sorts of questions about it. It's a perpetrator in that case who was a Nazi, who had the Black Sun symbol. He had loads of evidence around that he wanted to get out to people, almost like saying, look, I'm a Nazi. And the intelligence services in New Zealand had been warned about him. He was at a gun club in Dunedin. Various people there were phoning up the intelligence services in New Zealand saying, look, this guy's dangerous. Can you keep a very close eye on him? Mm. Nothing happened. And of course, then he went and killed a whole bunch of Muslims. But the idea was that he's a lone nut in that case. So we're not really talking about a false flag attack of any sort, really. But he's a lone nut, and he's not connected to Nazis, which he obviously was. So we know Nazis are a thing. You know, there's a very much an international Nazi network. The Order of Nine Angles I mentioned earlier on is a large part of that, which Yvette Cooper seems to be quite happy sitting down next to them and having a little chit-chat and a cup of tea or drinking blood. I'm not sure quite what they do together. She's not going to proscribe them. So the mosque massacre, is that, you got anything to say about that, since it's your territory?
Well, you know, I should, but at that time, you know, I wasn't actually as had my ear to the ground as much as I do the last 5 years. That was just before I really got engaged with what's going on as much. So all I can say on that one is a bit more peripheral. Like, my uncle commented on that. I remember it really stuck out to me. He said, oh, look, well, it's terrible. You know, there's a pretty good justification for having a, you know, this sort of surveillance powers, isn't it? I was like, oh no, because they've got those. It's actually proof that they don't work, or at least not in the way that we're told they're supposed to. You know, I've heard it also reported that, in fact, there hasn't been, there may arguably, but contentiously, be only one instance where a terrorist attack has actually been stopped since the introduction of things like the Patriot Act and this massive spying network that they have on all of our blimmin' phones now, in all our pockets. You know, it's an incredible, unprecedented amount of reach that they have. But on the other hand, this technology we know has been used to go after journalists.
Well, hang on. New Zealand has been prosecuting Israelis who, for example, there were some Israelis who were going around the wreckage of Christchurch, funnily enough, when there was an earthquake there, grabbing people's passports, and they were all arrested over in New Zealand and prosecuted. So there was no impunity for them. And also, Jacinda had been making noises about the Prime Minister of New Zealand about the supporting the Palestinians.
She was what, sorry? She was
making noises about supporting Palestine.
Right. Oh, was she
this
really?
This is before the massacre, yeah. There's all sorts of things. I mean, of course, Princess Diana was talking about that sort of thing too.
And came
a bit of a cropper.
Yeah, and Jacinda came a cropper in a way. I was quite impressed with the smear campaign about her on social media, and it stood out to me. I thought something's going on here. I knew it could be about AUKUS. She was against joining AUKUS, and the day she left, oh, they're suddenly talking about joining AUKUS. Yeah. So, yeah.
What is AUKUS? This is part of Australia and New Zealand, is it?
Yeah, it's a US, UK, Australia at the moment, but they wanted to tack on an NZ on the end. It's really, you know, the US's interests, shall we say, in the Pacific, especially with the growth of China. And so, you know, China is New Zealand and Australia's biggest trade partner. And so the US is trying to convince us that China's our enemy. And so how that all works out in our interests, I'm not sure. So, you know, we'd like to have some leaders with some, I suppose they need moral courage, because the US obviously has their fingers in so many pies and a lot of clout, but that clout is diminishing, and that's what this desperation that Craig Murray talked about is clear, and Trump talking about de-dollarization. China is, you know, the G7 is on the way down, and the BRICS coalition now is actually a larger economic force. So I think there's hope. And also a great story today that France's parliamentary has published a report that basically called Europe's current political socio-political strategy as a vassal to the US, and said that it's terrible for them. Of course it is. I mean, my gosh.
We're going to have a Frexit then, are we?
You know, with all these sanctions on Russia backfiring, yeah. The gas that we could have got from Nord Stream would have given us such cheaper gas than what we've got. Funnily enough, we're getting that now from the US.
Well, look, let's cut to the chase here, because it looks to me as if there's a small cult-like group of elite that are trying to control Europe and America. They're trying to make a United States of Europe, just like the United States of America, which is all controlled by, like, a handful of people in Washington or in Brussels, or maybe the same people elsewhere. I don't know. Maybe they're in Reykjavik or something, the people that really control. Maybe they're in London.
Yeah, maybe central banks. London.
But this centralisation of power is what all this is about. They're not interested in people. They're not interested in the principle of democracy, which is the people rule in Greek. They're not interested in that at all. They just want, you know, isn't it Dr. No, the James Bond film where he says, world domination. Same old dream. It's the same. That's what they're up to, folks.
That's right.
Anyway, also, another little anecdote from 7/7 was I got to know a bit at the time, in the sort of 2005-6/7 period, a guy called Nafiz Ahmed, who wrote a book called the London Bombings, an independent inquiry. And although and this is used by academics all over the world, but one of the things he told us, which was the publishers refused. He wanted all the way through to write the book to write alleged bombers. They refused. They said, oh, well, we've got this far, we're about to publish it, but we've taken out all the alleged in front of the bombers. I hope that's all right. And then, of course, Nafees is now working very closely with MI6. A lot of what he says is similar to the sort of Paul Mason stuff, etc. So, yeah, you know, so anyway, so he's been sort of told, I'm guessing here, not making any absolute factual statements, but I'm guessing that he's just been told, look, if you want a career, stay away from all that stuff about the 7/7 London bombings being done by the Israelis. So not only was Netanyahu in London that day, there were all sorts of other fascinating little aspects to it which have come out over the years, not least of which is the, you know, was mentioning about the company Verint Systems, who had access to the tube tunnels, because the London Underground was privatized just a couple of months before the bombings, and straight away a company to do CCTV, an Israeli firm, were given a contract, and they had access to the tube tunnels called Verint. And if you looked into Verint, as I was doing not long afterwards, you found that the boss of the parent company, Kobe Alexander, was on the run. He was a crooked businessman who the American Securities and Exchange Commission were after, having defrauded the New York Stock Exchange. So this is a crooked company run by ex-Israeli military. The guy who was running Verint was ex-Corps of Engineers in the Israeli Army. So he would have been the guy probably in charge of strapping the bombs underneath the trains. The idea, of course, is to frame Muslims. And if you go up to where this all started, apparently at the Iqra bookshop in Beeston in Leeds, where Tanweer and Khan, two of the alleged bombers, were, there was a guy running that bookshop called Martin McDade. Martin McDade was a former special boat service. He was a convert to Islam, apparently, worked for the British Special Forces. So the British Special Forces were running a bookshop where the bombers were in Leeds. And then there was Martin Gilbertson, who he was up there doing their computers in the bookshop, and he reported them to West Yorkshire Police a couple of years before the bombings. He said, look, these guys are a bit radical, a bit crazy. Particularly, he pointed out Martin McDade, who they were all part of this thing called Al-Majaroon. Al-Majaroon, MI5. Mm-hmm. Al-Majaroon, MI5. Mm. So even the people in Finsbury Park Mosque were saying, look, these guys from Al-Majaroon in our mosque here are really crazy. Can you just stop them? Do something about them? Metropolitan Police saying, oh, yeah, well, okay, we'll try. But it was all being run by the security services, so the Met couldn't really intervene. So that's how they do it, folks, just to untangle that from 20 years ago. And when they're trying to pull your heartstrings, saying, oh, those Muslims, they're so nasty, oh dear, isn't it awful what they did to us? No, it's the Israelis, and it's Benjamin Netanyahu. No doubt about it whatsoever, he was involved in all of that. Anyway, if you're interested in more in detail, there is this rather nice documentary called Ludicrous Diversion, which is the title of the documentary. It came out about 8 months after the bombings, and he goes into loads of details in this documentary about things which just do not make any sense about the official government story of what is supposed to have happened. And even Jon Snow, go and if you ever find Jon Snow in his retirement on a beach somewhere, wherever he is, from Channel 4 News, ask him about it, because he knows. He went all the way down the tunnels with Channel 4 News, taking pictures of the all the cameras, counting the cameras, 15, 16, 17, 25 cameras here, but they haven't got a single picture of the guys on the tube. So did they even do it? No, they didn't. I will stick my neck out and say no. They were probably killed at Canary Wharf, and the people who really did it were Verint Systems. This is at least what I think is probably going on. So anyway, let's have a listen just to round up this little section on the 20th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings by having a listen to the a little clip from the Ludicrous Diversion.
So if you genuinely believed it was unlikely or even impossible that the police would ever fabricate evidence in order to give the appearance of having solved a crime, it is time to reassess your belief. They have, they do, and they will again. If we learn one thing from these incidents, it is this. The police view themselves as above the law. And if we learn another thing, it is that they are. In the wake of the bombs, Britain has been left a changed nation. Already the country with the most surveillance in the world, the UK is set to move further towards a literal Big Brother society. Tony Blair said at the 2005 Labour Party conference, "We know we need strict controls in a changing world." Really, Tony? We know we need strict controls? Exactly who do you mean by we? The British public? The government and police? Or you and your friends? And how exactly are these strict controls going to stop potential terrorists being aggrieved by our foreign policy? And how would these controls have prevented the attacks in London? We have just been fortunate enough to see these strict controls in their true light during the latest terrorist threat, which played out across the UK like an Orwellian pantomime. On the 10th of August, 24 supposed terrorists were arrested. They were allegedly just about to blow up 10 planes in mid-air using liquid explosives, despite the fact they had no bombs, no plane tickets, and several of them didn't even have passports. With the threat apparently foiled, the terrorist alert level immediately went up to critical, indicating that a terrorist attack was still deemed imminent. In response to this insanity, the airports immediately introduced an absurd draconian policy regarding carry-on luggage. No liquids could be carried onto the plane. iPods, phones, and even books were banned, and mothers were made to taste their baby milk to prove it wasn't explosive. Thankfully, our Prime Minister managed to depart for his family holiday in the Caribbean before the airport clampdown occurred. As Blair also helpfully explained at the Labour conference, ID cards, traditionally resisted by the public, would be introduced. Again, because he says they are necessary in a changing world. But every one of the four alleged 77 bombers would have legally had one. So what are they hoping to achieve with them? ID cards will have the same effect on preventing terrorism as license plates have in preventing car crashes. And there's now talk of introducing biometric identification, iris scans, and body scanners. Who is actually being watched here? The so-called terrorists, or us?
So that's just a little clip from the Ludicrous Diversion film. And he points out in there, Matt, that we've had all these miscarriages of justice, the Birmingham 6, the Guildford 4, particularly when it comes to terrorism. It seems that the police have got these special little units they use to fit people up.
Right. And, yeah, so it's what they're using. They don't seem to be stopping terrorism with these powers. That's the excuse that they use them for. but with giving up so many of our civil liberties in order for them to do it, it's almost like, well, what is that the real plan? You know, yeah, all of these sweeping powers. You know, I love the quote from Thomas Jefferson, "Those who sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither." You know, of course, there's risks with having a free and open society, but the risks of having one that are, you know, completely controlled by a central authority are far greater. Yeah, I feel the same about censoring myself on Past an Action. You know, the risk of being in prison, yep, that's terrible, but the risk of living in a society where I cannot speak about non-violent direct action to stop the ultimate crime, far more terrifying to me. So, yep, lock me up.
Okay, so the City of London come into a lot of this, whether it's the courts or the financial power not to give any money to disabled people, which they seem to be hell-bent on. Very interesting little group. And I was watching a film which was pointed out to me by Steve Hall called The Spider's Web about the City of London. Well worth a watch. And there's a section towards the end of it, I think this is made about a decade ago, where there's some activists go into this massive banquet where they've got the head of HMRC, which is the Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, sitting there, and he's just given a massive tax break a few weeks previously to British Telecom. You know, like, oh, you don't have to pay the tax. Yeah, and so they go into him and they give him an award in this banquet. I think it's in one of these big banqueting halls in London, somewhere in the city, somewhere. And the great thing about that action was that so many of the people sitting around him think that it's a real award. The only person that realizes that they're taking the mickey is him, and he gets very agitated. And you can see there's all this confusion going around about that. Oh dear, why is he getting upset? This is great, he's getting an award. And of course, it shows you, doesn't it, that the sort of people that are sitting around that table in the city are the people that love getting awards. They want to be made a knight or a lord or something, you know. They're That's looking right. for status. Yeah. We want some status, please give us some status. And so anyway, so let's have a little listen to this. It's just from the Money Masters about the City of London, a bit about, actually, it's about the Rothschild and the development of the Rothschild Bank.
This is Frankfurt, Germany. 50 years after the Bank of England opened its doors, a goldsmith named Amschel Moses Bauer opened the coin shop, a counting house, in 1743. And over the door, he placed a sign depicting a Roman eagle on a red shield. The shop became known as the Red Shield Firm, or in German, Rothschild. When his son, Amschel Meyer Bauer, inherited the business, he decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayor Rothschild had five sons. He trained them all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Meyer, stayed in Frankfurt to mind the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Nathan, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England.
So this is the role of the Rothschild family. What's your thoughts about this, Matt? I know quite particularly people on the left who will say, oh, Rothschild, it's just a conspiracy. You must be a conspiracy nut. You're anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Now, we had this quite a lot, but they certainly seem to be very powerful in Europe, particularly in these various different countries. I think it was France, Italy, Germany and Britain, where the Rothschild family founded banks.
Yeah, and is it true that they were really behind the Balfour Declaration?
Well, Walter Rothschild drafted the Balfour Declaration.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. And I think that's where we have to keep looking. It's not really this party or that party controlling or running things. It's these huge financial organizations like the central banks, the Rothschilds, and then even just below them, think like these multi-investment fund groups like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street.
Yeah.
They're really where the power sits, and the whole idea of this false duality of Labour and Tory and Democrat and Republican, which still has so much blimmin' sway on people get so hit up on that. Oh no, anyone but Trump. And on the other side, you know, I was speaking to people on, like, Democrat supporters don't realize they're in a cult as well. It's like, your cult is anyone but Trump. You know, it seems pale by comparison, but no, it's just all a distraction to stop us actually, you know, making actual change that we want. You know, they're both detached from what the people need and want.
Well, they're both very much attached to the international financial oligarchy. So, instead of doing a normal break, we're going to do a slightly shorter one. But you, on your little list of news items for this week, you've got here Black Sabbath.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I had an incredible opportunity to go and see the very last gig of Ozzy Osbourne with Black Sabbath, which I had to take, and it came about last minute. I was very excited. I tried and failed to get tickets originally. So, you know, they're definitely an influential band for me that I was very much looking forward to, but it turned into quite an interesting journey that to me revealed a lot about Great Britain. And, you know, you're cautious not to take any too much away from certain things, but it's just something that's cropped up over and over again, my experience in the UK from the time I arrived, literally, at the gates, is obsequience. You know, pushing the worst interpretations of the rules, not simply following them, but the worst possible interpretation, and just not using any imagination or compassion, this sort of like, yeah, fawning obsequience to rules. And it's almost like a religion, I believe. So I think it's, yeah. Do you want me to tell that story now briefly or like, yeah. All right. So I put out a message on Twitter. Someone responded with saying they had a ticket that they bought through the football club because it was Aston Villa, this football stadium. So they couldn't resell it on the normal channels through Ticketmaster. So I got, they were a bit desperate. So I managed to get a cheap general admission ticket from them. And they had a second one, so we sold that on the day we went there. I met this guy from Birmingham. You know, I was really excited. As I say, Black Sabbath means a lot to me, and all these groups that they inspired were playing too. So it wasn't just Sabbath, but Pantera, Slayer, all the groups, Alice in Chains. Quite an amazing event, really. I mean, Black Sabbath are like the Beatles of heavy rock. So they really started it all. Amazing story of Tony Iommi chopping his fingers off and replacing them, boiling down a plastic dishwasher liquid container to make these nibs that he could play the guitar with. He'd almost given up. And that actually created their sound because he had to tune down, and it gave him that tremolo that just sounds like nothing else. So I like that story in terms of adaptation. And yeah, but in terms of what I encountered, so I get to the gate and... unfortunately, because I was traveling from London, having gone at the Palestine Action and all the rest of it, I had my laptop in my bag. I didn't realize that's not okay. And so they said, no, you can't bring that in. And I also didn't realize that the guy that was giving me the ticket had already scanned it. So they said, look, you got to go resolve that. I was like, right. So I did that, walked around and around until I found somebody, gave them my bag, which is amazing. And I went back to the gate and they said, well, where's your ticket? I was like, well, what are you talking about? It was already scanned. And you told me to go deal with the laptop. So I come back there like, no, you can't. You don't have a ticket. I was like, what are you talking about? It's just like, I spent 8 hours just pleading and trying to reason with them. I was like, look, I came to the gate. You all saw me. There was 20 security guards watching, sitting on the steps. And I noticed that there was this gleeful look in some of their eyes. Like, they knew what was going down. None of them were willing to, like, speak up and say, hey, come on. We saw this. Like, just let him in. In New Zealand, I know that's what would have happened.
Well, it depends. I think you're dealing with some satanic people. Yeah, that's the trouble. I mean, okay, so when they turned up in 1970 playing songs like we can hear underneath here, and War Pigs, they were one thing. It's always, I mean, I have to say something about Hawkwind, because they were a fantastic band back in the 1970s. Mm. Nowadays, ugh, rubbish. I think it's just the producers have taken it all over. But anyway, let's have a listen to... interesting. Did you actually get to see them?
Well, that's the end of the story. So, and I'd push back on the satanic thing. No, they're actually God-fearing people. They wear crucifixes, not upside down. No, I promise you that... No.
They're not. If they're messing around with you and stopping you getting in...
But that's not Sabbath. That's the security company. And so... No, it's quite surprising, but Ozzy Osbourne, you hear him speak, he sings about God and loving God, and, you know, so it is, I know he brands himself as anything but if you listen carefully, he talks about love of God. So anyway, but no, this sort of obsequience, like this ridiculous enforcing of rules, brutal enforcing into the worst possible interpretation. I mean, anyone with just a heart. I mean, I told them even that, I told them I've sacrificed everything, and I listed it. I was like, okay, I met my mum yesterday in London. We had plans to go to see a Michael Jackson musical. I said, look, I'm so sorry. It was a very difficult choice. I was like, and she told me to my face, this might be the last time I'm in London, might be the last time I see her. And I gave up the chance to see her again the next day and go to this gig. So I go to Sabbath. She understood because it meant so much to me. I also gave up seed funding
for her. So were they human, or did you get to see it or not?
Well, that's it. Okay, I'll finish real quickly. But so I also gave up seed funding for a creative project I've been dreaming up for 5 years, and an oath I made to my teenage friend, and also the fact, you know, money for the next 2 weeks that I was going to live on. I knew I'd be starving for 2 weeks. And I gave all that up to go see this, and I told the security guards all this, and they still wouldn't let me in. I spent 8 hours. Not a single person would see reason.
No.
And didn't get to see them. That's it. So I spent 8 hours banging my head against the wall, And what I took from that is just subsequence, that, you know, it's the banality of evil. It's not just the people making the rules. It's all the people upholding them, not actually using some imagination and some heart, human heart, and going, look, this guy's clearly, this is not right.
If you'd have had the right tattoo, they'd probably have let you in. Anyway,
no, you're reading it wrong. It's not like
maybe,
that at all.
Maybe. They're really nice guys nowadays. Anyway, let's have a listen to the rest of the War Pigs thing.
Darkness world stops turning, ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and as God has struck the hour, day of judgment God is calling. On the knees the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh Lord, yeah.
That's Black Sabbath with a little bit of Matt talking about his difficulties getting into the last gig of Black Sabbath. Maybe there was some sort of secret ritual going on in there. What do you think?
Oh, there was. Beautiful. I wish I was there for it. but I mean, it's just the culmination of the things I've tried to help reserve my judgment about, but I've seen over and over again in the UK personally. You know, I went through many countries wearing my Assange outfit. I got fist bumps in the German airport from the security guard. It was only in the UK where I got immediately chucked into a cell and interrogated for hours. And so, and other horrible just encounters of people just with no imagination. It's not even enforcing the rules. It's hallucinating what could be the worst interpretation of the rules. and enforcing that. And it's just, to me, it's the banality of evil, the obsequience to these terrible ideas, and that's what upholds them. And we've got to get off that.
So it's nothing to do with black and white, good and evil.
I don't believe in black and white, good and evil at all.
I do, so we can just make to differ there, right?
No, that's right. It's your,
Patricia's got a poem this week, The Squaring of Le Cercle, A Tale of Yore, re 7-7. Le Cercle is dark, shadowing heaven. Peter Power, a stooge may be, simulating reality. So many threads that day we'll find, if digging done with unbiased mind. BB in town. Oh, what a wheeze, finance minister. Conference, please. The same hotel, Liverpool Street, where BB businessmen should meet with a Masonic temple off the street. Tall tales abound with many holes. A tip-off came so very bold from Scotland Yard. Stay where you are, lock down, be safe. Oh, what a star. A story spun, web of deceit, spin sympathy, then hero greet. So many loops, loop-de-loo, so many gaps we all see through. No answers, but questions run very deep. For World War III, suspicion creeps. Scapegoat the East in the middle. Muslims blame, mark them, the riddle. Special forces do all they can as US-UK push on with plan. As Greater Israel by hook or crook. Hegemony all by the book. Thanks very much, Patricia. Maybe we can even get you to read some of these. It would be nice to get you to read them out. I think you probably read them better than I do.
Who?
Me? Patricia.
Oh, Patricia.
Well, you can try, I suppose. anyway, we also on your list is the biggie, I think, one of the biggies this week anyway, is Epstein.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump getting very uncomfortable talking about it. He was brought up at a cabinet meeting earlier this week, and he's saying, "Oh, that's an old story. Why are you talking about Epstein?"
Yeah, that's right. It's scandalous. His whole, you know, huge part of his base is shocked because they really did campaign as if they were going to get justice on this, and for a lot of people, his base really cares a lot about it. So he's. Yeah, he's really selling his base up the river.
I think it was Judge Neapolitano talking to Max Blumenthal about this, where they played a couple of quicks. It may have been some other podcast, but it was excellent to hear Trump being quizzed about releasing the 9/11 files, releasing the JFK files, and releasing the Epstein files when he was running for president last year. And he was a little bit reluctant, as you'll hear in a moment, to talk about the Epstein files last year. So one has to wonder, in the background of all of this, is there something on the hard drive of Donald Trump in Epstein Island with underage boys or girls? Who knows? But there may well be. And this, of course, is an extremely useful tool that people like Benjamin Netanyahu could be using on the little trip to Washington to threaten, blackmail a certain Mr. Donald Trump with. So anyway, let's have a listen to that. Make up your own mind, but have a listen to the encounter this week. But before that, we've got a clip from an interview with Trump whilst he was on the campaign trail last year.
Would you declassify the 9/11?
Yeah.
Would you declassify JFK files?
Yeah.
Would you?
I did a lot of it.
Would you declassify the Epstein files?
Yeah, I would.
All right.
I guess I would. I think that less so because, you know, you don't know. You don't want to affect people's lives if it's phony stuff in there because there's a lot of phony stuff with that whole world. But I think I would, or at least
I... Do you think that would restore trust? Help restore trust?
Yeah, I don't know about Epstein so much as I do the others. I didn't know you were going to be talking about this.
Your memo and release yesterday on Jeffrey Epstein, it left some lingering mysteries. One of the biggest ones is whether he ever worked for a American or foreign intelligence agency. The former Labor Secretary, who was Miami U.S. Attorney, Alex Acosta, he allegedly said that he did work for an intelligence agency. So could you resolve whether or not he did? And also, could you say why there was a minute missing from the jailhouse tape on the minute set?
Yeah, sure.
Did I just interrupt for a second? Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. You're asking, we have Texas, we have this, we have all of the things. And are people still talking about this guy, this creep? That is unbelievable. Do you want to waste the time and do you feel like answering?
I don't mind answering.
I mean, I can't believe you're asking a question on Epstein at a time like this where we're having some of the greatest success and also tragedy with what happened in Texas. It just seems like a desecration, but you go ahead.
See, they're not fake news now, mate, are they? They're asking you some rather awkward questions and you don't want to answer them.
Yeah, and you heard in that first clip, he's, will you release JFK? Yep. You know, the 9/11, yep, straight off the bat. And then long pause. Ooh. And then he immediately rolls into saying, well, you don't know who could be. And then he slows down, And then he says, and they're phony. You know, all of that just sounds like a guilty person trying to sow the seeds. If he's implicated. And of course, it seemed like what they're trying to say this week is that there is no client list, even though Pam Bondi said she had files on her desk. Now, she didn't specifically say it was a client list, but other people have pointed out, well, how did they actually prosecute and now jail Ghislaine Maxwell if they don't have any evidence? You know, because she was prosecuted for child trafficking. If they don't know who they trafficked to, that indicates that she was prosecuted, she should be let out. And that Epstein should not have killed himself because he wouldn't have faced any time either. But he killed himself in jail, didn't he, Tony? Was that what happened?
No. He was murdered in jail. He was assassinated, really, because he was a political. The question here, really, is as he was putting there, was he working for a foreign intelligence service? He doesn't name the Mossad, but obviously many people have that in their minds, and I will, because the Mossad were very connected, of course, as everybody should know, to Ghislaine Maxwell through her father, Robert Maxwell, and so Robert Maxwell was working for the Mossad, so maybe his daughter might have had a connection with them too. So this would explain a lot, wouldn't it? You know, the idea is you've got a honey trap here, and people are sent over there. Once they've got film of them doing things they shouldn't be doing, then those people are then propelled into positions of power.
Yeah, that's right. It's the Russians called kompromat. And I mentioned John Kariakou earlier. He also talked about Epstein. He also, I believe, said he wasn't as ready to believe in that one, but now he is. And he sort of talks about the fact that, well, you get these, you know, you want access. If you are Mossad or Israel, you do want access to these powerful people, but you can't just go out and get that. But somebody, you know, if you're in the government or if you're in Mossad, but if you get someone else to do it for you, someone who's, you know, can entertain them, you know, it's another way to do it. Who was Epstein? He was a, you know, he was hired as a math teacher, and then some scandal about children at the school, and then he ended up being given a whole lot of money and an island. How does a math teacher do that? I would like to know. I was a teacher before I became an activist, you know. Yeah, it's Mossad. If you want to pay me, you know, but I probably won't do my, you know, probably won't do what you want me to. But if you just want to give me some money, I'd love to have an island. But yeah, what did Epstein have to do for you to get that? You know, you got to wonder. But yeah, it is a great weapon, of course, if you can get compromised, and then anyone that gets through, you've got something to hang over them. You step out of line. And Trump certainly seems very anxious about that himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he's making lots of efforts to help the Israelis in their genocide. Not really doing what he said he'd do, of course, which is to stop the conflict. Not interested in stopping it. And it could be simply that they've got this, as you quite nicely put it, compromat on him. Instead, what Trump is doing is he's... because, of course, this is really all about the horrors and the slaughter ongoing in Gaza. And I was disgusted to hear the BBC, I was it yesterday or Wednesday possibly, leading all their news bulletins with the Russians are doing terrible things in Kiev. No. Actually, so two people had been killed overnight in the Russian bombing of Kiev. And yet you've got literally scores of people being killed every day, including in hospitals and whilst in food queues, the Israelis. And nothing is said by the BBC about that. Oh, no, we're not really interested in that. Sorry. But somebody who is doing a lot for raising awareness around the West is Francesco Albanese. And there's a bit of a competition, isn't there, because Trump is trying to get his peace prize, you know, even though he hasn't got peace. There was talk about that when they had the ceasefire back in, was it January, February time? But actually, a lot of people are saying Francesca Albanese is the one.
Yeah, I mean, she stands out in my mind, doesn't she? And I think history will observe it that way.
Special rapporteur for the UN.
Yeah, that's for Palestine, yeah. This special rapporteur on torture was what got me in to be aware of the Assange case. So they do great work. Yeah, history will observe her as you know, the same way Assange will. All these people that, it's like the emperor's no new clothes. They think they're getting away with it, but we can all see it. History will see it. They're losing their integrity. They're trying to carry on as if we're still in the 20th century, but we all have phones. We can all receive and share and record information like never before, and they just can't get away with it. So their options are to become more tyrannical or to stop being so terrible.
They seem to be on a sort of one-way street, basically. So the mainstream press is totally compromised, and so they have to find things like, oh, we're going to have fact checkers to stop the facts. In fact, our Palestine Coalition, Bristol Palestine Coalition Facebook group a couple of weeks ago was nearly just completely taken down. Somebody at Facebook actually went in there and said, oh, actually, no, I think it's a human being. I had a look and said, there's nothing wrong with this. They're not doing anything wrong. So it was then restored, even though everybody who were admins on that group and moderators have been sent a little message saying that group has now been taken down. Forget it. It's gone. You know, so anyway, they're still there, thank God. But this is the people we rely on, is our media, to actually be there, the platforms to talk about these things. So anyway, here's Francesca Albanese. It's nice to have her on as often as possible, talking about this whole sort of attempt to sanction her now. The US regime under Donald Trump is putting her under sanctions and her whole department, which is disgusting.
Again,
I'm still evaluating the impact. Of course, it's. I agree. I'm happy that the Human Rights Council, members of the Human Rights Council, and the Office of the High Commissioner, the UN, the human rights community has reacted, criticizing and asking for the reversal of these measures, because it's obscene, frankly. But right now, I want to remind everyone that the reason why these sanctions have been imposed is the pursuit of justice. Of course, I've been critical of Israel. It has been committing genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes, and not because I say that. There are criminal proceedings and international Court of Justice proceedings against Israel for these crimes. Isn't it enough? And what I've exposed is that this genocide doesn't only go ahead because of the unrelinquished territorial ambitions of Israel or because of ideological affinity of some groups with what Israel is doing, but also because there are companies who are profiting from it. And excuse me, I mean, I record the offensive and rude posture that has come from some of these companies in reaction to my report, like Google. But I mean, look, I'm also a user of Google. I don't want the end of Google. I want Google to stop being, making profits by supporting a government that has killed 60,000 people, including 18,000 children. Is it too much to ask? So, of course, the sanctions are going to affect me, and they are not going to stop my quest for respect of justice and international law, as I've been mandated to do by the Human Rights Council.
So that's Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur for human rights in Palestine, who's been doing a sterling work around the world in at least pointing out some of these hideous crimes, which much of the mainstream press in the West, Matt, seems to be trying to turn its head away from.
That's key, isn't it? I really believe that if we have a functioning media sphere in the 21st century and we preserve freedom of speech, we will have an unprecedented century of justice, peace, and a world that works for everybody, simply because everyone can be more informed, and no longer can the empire rely on controlling a very tiny group of media conglomerates that control the entire narrative. You know, it's the emperor's new clothes. We can see through it now. And as long as we don't allow them to censor us, we really are at a pivotal turning point for humanity. It's like the printing press, but even more so, because now we've all got that power. And it's like shining a light on everything, exposed, isn't it? So we've just got to hold on to freedom of speech, and I really believe...
Well, it's not much power, is it? It's not the power to reach millions. It's the power to reach maybe 10, you know. So that's the deal that they've done, is they say, well, we'll let the people talk to each other, a few of them, but we're going to still completely control the mainstream press and make sure the truth is...
I disagree with that because you've got independent voices. You know, you can say you criticise this one and that one. No one's perfect. You know, you got your Joe Rogans, though, who's now 10 times rating higher than Fox and 8 times higher than CNN. And, you know, he sits there and, you know, he has long-form conversations, but sometimes very good ones with very interesting people. You know, he puts people on that wouldn't get on the other channels. And he does talk about Gaza. He does talk about 1948.
But there's a lot of controlled opposition. Quite a lot of controlled opposition. Well, I'm not saying Joe Rogan is. Who knows? But, you know, there is a lot of it about. And I have to look at the, you know, there's the nutter magnets as well.
Sure. But, you know, that's the risk. But someone like me was not able to get on to New Zealand media except for one time on Radio New Zealand. But I was able to get 500,000 views a couple of times on TikTok,
yeah,
which is perhaps why they're trying to ban that.
Ah, right, yeah, it is. Anyway, look, the really important people are those in Gaza right now. Fatima is there. She's been doing reports the last few weeks, every week for us, so let's go to Fatima in northern Gaza now, our little exclusive. She can't say exactly what her real name is or where she is, but she keeps sending the reports in, thank God.
Hi, this is Fatima, reaching out to you from a corner of a freedom in northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. My today's report is about a story from the shore, as my friend currently is in a displacement camp, and this is her story. Along the battered coast of Gaza, my friend now lives in a tent, if it can be called that. She and her family, like thousands of others, were forced from their home and ended up in a makeshift displacement camp. There, under scraps of cloth and plastic, they try to survive the unrelenting heat of the sun and the bitter cold of the night. She tells me life has become unbearable. There is barely any food, and clean water is a dream. The children cry from hunger. The elderly suffer in silence. And sickness spreads quickly in the overcrowded, unsanitary camp. Many have already fallen ill, and then there is the hunger. The cruel policy of starvation has left many visibly weak and malnourished. Even walking has become difficult for some. Her voice trembled as she shared her deepest fear, losing her brothers. Like many others, they once joined a group headed to the Annapolis roundabout in hopes of finding aid. But every journey there is a gamble of with death. Israeli occupation forces has repeatedly targeted such gatherings. She waited that day, watching the road with dry eyes and a silent heart, praying her brothers would return. By evening they did, but not everyone's dead. This is her life now. No safety, no certainty, only the daily fight to stay alive and not to lose hope on the edge of a forgotten shore. Thank you.
So that's a latest report from Fatima, a little family story. You know, you do wonder whether these young men living there think to themselves, well, I'd rather just pick up a gun, join Hamas, rather than die trying to get aid. I'd rather try and actually stand up, take up arms against these invaders.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, wonderful. So just to note, that's a journalist that, you know, on the ground, able to get a story out that perhaps wouldn't have been able to in the 20th century. But yeah, that's right. And talking about our media, how they fail, to me, there's only one question you need to ask any supporter that's still supporting Israel, or even at the very beginning, would be to say that the whole ruse that, okay, they're going in there to stop Hamas, well, the only question you need to ask anyone putting that forward is, well, what do you say to the fact that Netanyahu funded Hamas right up till October 7, and that fact has even been corroborated by former Israeli Prime Minister. There's even a Wikipedia page about it. There's WikiLeaks cables about it. You know, so the whole thing is basically undone by that one fact, and it's just never brought up.
What's motivating Netanyahu, do you think?
Well, yeah, clearly it's something else. He doesn't want to stop Hamas. He doesn't want the hostages back. He's had so many opportunities to get them back. He's had protests in Israel to that extent that he's not. He's clearly not. It's obvious what he really wants is to colonize and Palestine completely. And now, you know, it's been really dark to see this week that Trump calling Netanyahu the greatest man on earth and Netanyahu giving Trump the nomination for the Peace Prize. It really indicates, and literally talking about forcible displacement, although they call it voluntary. But of course, you know, you're shooting people going to get food who are starved, been starved for 75 days without aid. Of course, people are going to want to leave. So the voluntary idea is a sick joke, isn't it? So I've been really conscious this week that, okay, they are really going to try to move in and finish the job. Horrible way to say it, but that's it, isn't it? And, I think we all need to do more now, right now. We all need to think about what we can do. I've been looking at the Freedom Flotilla idea, which of course Greta Thunberg took part in the last one. That was one ship, and of course they stopped that. But if we overwhelmed them with more than 20 ships, I was speaking to AI about this, like how many ships do you think we would need to overwhelm the blockade?
Hang on, you were speaking to AI about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're giving your plans over to Elon Musk and Sam Altman.
Yeah, that's a valid point. That's a valid point. But these plans are already out there anyway.
I mean, if you're going to have a successful plan, surely, you're going to have to keep it up
your
sleeve.
This is already public, though. That's a valid point. But this has already been spoken about, this Freedom Flotilla idea, to have a larger fleet this time and to have more than they can handle, and it can be a peaceful one. Doesn't have to be any. There could be a military accompaniment, but I don't think there should or necessarily need to be. I think it's more powerful if you go there completely unarmed. You're taking aid, and then they stop you. Even if you fail, it's a scandal. It highlights the hypocrisy of it. But if you have enough ships, I think of about the time when in Auckland Harbour, a US warship was greeted by a whole fleet, flotilla of random assortment of vessels, of kayaks to sailing boats. They go out there and greet this US warship and a submarine. And what it did was it really galvanized public support for the anti-nuclear campaign, and it was what actually turned the tide. And eventually David Lange brought it in and said, no, we're stopping these ships coming in. So it just shows people power. I'd love to see that flotilla. I'm kind of tempted to join it. And the other wonderful thing that happening this week I see is that Spain and Ireland have just announced they're going to join a 20-country bloc to impose real sanctions and other measures on Israel. So things are now at the this is the desperate final last hour. I don't think we can allow ourselves to let this happen. And so everybody, do all you can right now. We cannot live down in history to have allowed the first live stream genocide to go down. I just don't see how we can move forward with our heads held up. We've got to do all we can right now.
Your socials, Matt, you're just off now, so people want are interested in following you, finding you.
Yeah, Matt O'Branon, which is O-B-R-A-N-A-N-I-N. I'm on the
Matt O'Branane.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Spelt like that, Branane.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks a lot, Tony.
Okay. We're going to go back to Epstein now, as annoying as though it is.
Mm.
The guy who killed Jeffrey Epstein, so we're about to hear from Don DeBar as a New York journalist from Pacifica Radio. He's fingered a guy called Nicholas Taglioni. Nicholas Taglioni is a former policeman who's now in prison for three murders to do with a drug deal, as he explains. And I just must apologise because there's a bit of an echo on Don's recording here. But I will put the full version up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, as I will with one with Neil Goodwin and other longer pieces. But here is Don DeBar explaining why he thinks that this is the guy that killed Epstein, that Epstein certainly didn't commit suicide, and also, as we heard from the clip earlier on, the 1 minute of CCTV missing from the tapes from Epstein's cell.
I mean, so much of it is speculation because the list. who's got the list? With Trump, first of all, you know, when he's running for office the first time and the second time, The arithmetic for winning a presidential election in the United States is more than Byzantine, okay? You have 50 states, and each one of them is going to elect a group of people to go to the Electoral College and vote, or to send their vote to the Electoral College for president. People in the United States don't vote for the president. They vote for a slate of people who are going to vote for president, and state by state. And in some states, they're winner take all. If Bush beats Obama by one vote in a particular state that has 13 of these votes, Bush gets all 13 of them. In another state, if Obama beats Bush by one vote and there's 12 of them, then, or 13 of them, then Obama will get 7 and Bush will get 6. They do proportional splits on these. So when you're concocting a strategy for a presidential campaign, you're not trying to win the majority of voters nationally on issues, but rather piecing together this cloth over the face of the entire country, made up of, say, Cubans in Miami, say Haitians in St. Petersburg, Florida. So you have Cubans that are the right wing, the escapees of the revolution in 1960. Their children and grandchildren living in Miami. They're very right wing, politically. And you have people that escaped the right wing dictators in Haiti. Living on the other side of Florida, and they're much more progressive, and et cetera, et cetera. Trump wins both of them in the 2016 and 2024 election, I think also in the 2020, by pitching to each of them, like microcasting message. My point being, it's not like one broad package of messages that you present to an entire electorate, but rather a bunch of little piecemeal activities, where that's how you get become elected president. So when you're looking at things that you're going to say you're going to do and not do as president, when you have groups that are interested in what some consider marginal or even fringe issues, which some people consider Epstein's book and all that to be, some consider fracking, some consider, the COVID, whatever it is, you're looking at this map and where the people fall on this or that thing, and you're trying to piece together that magic number of votes of these, intermediaries to become elected president. And so he said lots of things to lots of people that sounded like, that basically people who are interested in finding out what exactly the hell Epstein was up to with Mossad, CIA, and whoever the hell else, that he was going to be looking into it. And the fact that it seemed that the CIA and FBI and everybody else were, after Trump, that they were vehemently opposed to and framing him and everything else, made it believable. And so a lot of people felt, once Trump gets in, we're finally going to get to the bottom of this. And now it seems like that's not true. So the question is, why? I don't know the answer to that yet. None of us do. But it may be, first of all, that the bottom of this is either not within his reach, or the bottom of this is going to result in triggering some reaction from some part of the government that he does not want to trigger, either ever or at this moment, you know, in terms of, you know, tactical thinking and, you know, an overall strategy. I don't know what it is. I do know a few things about it, though, and I know that, in my opinion, I mean, I don't know this, but I know enough facts to draw this as a conclusion, that he was murdered in that jail cell. I think I know who did it. I think Nicholas Tartaglione, who was a police officer in Briarcliff Manor, who was convicted of murdering four men in a cocaine deal gone bad, and then burying their bodies on some land he had in upstate New York, in Delaware County, that he was a cellmate of Epstein shortly before Epstein died, that while they were cellmates, apparently something happened where Epstein was injured in a way that some say is consistent with a suicide attempt, some others say with a murder attempt, and was hospitalized, and that at the time that Epstein died in 2019, that this guy, who had, according to the law, committed the murders in 2016, and who was looking at possibly being executed for the four murders, ended up being 5 years at sitting in jail without any conclusion. He was convicted at the time before Epstein died. It was a matter of awaiting sentencing. Will he be given the death penalty or not? And 5 years and after Epstein's death, we find out he's not going to be executed. He's going to have life in prison and probably crack it getting out at some point. So,
well, hang on, because that is, I mean, what is the death penalty for? If you've got a multiple murderer, police multiple murderer, totally abusing their position with public trust, what is the death penalty actually for?
I assume it's for people who were intending to commit some kind of revolutionary act, okay? It's something that actually strikes at the power structure. I think they have that on the books for that. But what they did do, of course, is whip up public support for it by holding out victims of, you know, like working class victims of, you know, psycho murderers that, you know, made people say, look, eye for an eye, okay, this was horrible what this guy did. And but so, meanwhile, I don't know how much more horrible it gets. I agree with you. He's a police officer. He's involved in a drug deal, a $250,000 cocaine deal, his money, trying to spin it for money. Somebody apparently hustled him out of the money, or he believed that they did. And so he baited them, got them to come to a place, his brother's bar, with two other ex-cops as bouncers, grabbed them, kidnapped them, tortured the one guy to death, and then killed the other three because they were witnesses. Shot him, executed back of the head. I don't know. If I was going to give the death penalty to someone and I wanted to make a point, that would seem like a pretty damn good case. Because it cuts across the board. People can't say, looking at that case, this is intended for black people, or this is intended for poor people, or this is intended as a weapon in the arsenal of the police against the people. This would, even if that's what it's intended for, this case would make the case that it's not. And yet, what happened was, Epstein ended up dead, and this guy didn't get the death penalty. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think people can draw their own conclusions, can't they? Quite happily from something like that. But look, what about, I mean, Epstein dead, Ghislaine Maxwell apparently in prison, although communicating with the outside world quite happily, apparently. And the tapes and the hard drive being maybe sitting there in Tel Aviv. I wonder, could Donald Trump be on there somewhere?
Who knows? You know, look. all right, so I mean, I know Cynthia McKinney well, and I know Dennis Kucinich to say hello to and stuff, and I know both of them and the positions they took with respect to Middle East policy, with respect to the wars in Iraq and potential war with Iran and all the other stuff that goes around it, and particularly with Israel and with AIPAC and the like. You know, I see what happened to Cynthia. She got driven out, and with Pelosi leading the charge, basically, out of the Congress. And Kucinich got districted out by Democrats, in essence, using Republicans in the state legislature in Ohio as, you know, as the face of it. So this entirely because Cynthia threw them out when APAC came to her with something they wanted her to sign that said that, you know, she was going to support Israel and anything that happened in the Congress. You know, if an elected legislator has the ability to bind their legislative activity in writing to a third party, I don't understand where that authority comes from. And the fact that they would do it to a foreign country seems like per se treason to me. But the fact that he can do it at all is frightening because certainly if you can do it because AIPAC is happy, then you can do it because this guy wrote you a check for $22 million or whatever. If you can buy my vote, then it's just a matter of setting a price.
Yeah, if you can buy my vote, it's just a matter of setting a price. And I think that says it all. Actually, fantastic, Don. Amazing. And I'll put up a link, quite obviously, to the articles about this guy, Nicholas Taglioni, who's this cop who seems to now be being favoured by the US justice system, which is about as corrupt as any kind of... well, you say banana republic. Banana republics are less corrupt than a massive place like the United States, which is trying to start World War III, because the mafia have it and it's in their complete grip, and the magic spell has been cast across the entire nation. So, yeah, anyway, so I put the full interview up, if you can bear the echoes. Fascinating guy, talking about Ukraine in great detail, as well as the Israel conflict and some of the shenanigans of Mr. Trump and his he's fall from grace really over in the States. Of course, it didn't take long. It didn't take our Keir Starmer very long either. And of course, at the back of a lot of this is the conflict with Iran. We've had this preposterous stuff coming out of the British security services this week, saying that the threat from Iran is greater than ever this week. They're trying to do this, that, and everything else. In fact, one of the journalists, apparently Iranian journalists, who was apparently targeted by the Iranians, wasn't actually targeted by the Iranians. She was told by MI5 that she was being targeted by the Iranians. So that's not quite the same as targeting by the Iranians, is it? And so they're just trying to cook up this hatred for Iran in this most disgusting, despicable way. And the worst thing is the way the mainstream press don't actually put this on them. You know, I'd love to be able to do that if I was still there. I would be questioning these wonks from Thames House or wherever they're from, the Home Office. It's funny, isn't it, all these places there where the Palestine Action is also being proscribed from the Home Office, which is the same place which is sending out ridiculous, stupid, pathetic rubbish about how Iran is targeting Britain. You know, so what a load of nonsense. Maybe they'll have to have another false flag attack. Maybe Netanyahu will have to come over here again and kill a load of Brits on the London Underground and blame that on Iran in order to try and convince everybody that this is not a lie, which it is. So Iran is a big part of all of this, and it's nice to hear from time to time, as we did with the defense editor of the Daily Mirror a couple of weeks ago, talking about Mossadegh. And well, you know, the British have already done coups in Iran. I'm not sure, I can't remember his name now, but anyway, what about the Iranian Revolution? Here is a guy called Roy Casagrande on talking about the origin of the Iran-Iraq War. So for those of you that weren't around, I certainly was in 1979 when the Iranians had their revolution. Back in the 1950s, the British had done a coup with the Americans against Mossadegh, the elected leader of Iran, and he was about to nationalise the petroleum industry in Iran, because the Brits said it was theirs, even though it wasn't their country. And he said, no, it's not, it's ours. And so he took his moment, It was about to nationalise everything, and then the British decided, oh, no, well, they'd just have a coup and get rid of him. And they did, and Mossadegh was gone, and the Shah arrived. Anyway, 1979, everything was turned on its head. Anyone that was around at that time will remember. I was actually over in the United States when it all happened, and I was thinking, gosh, this is interesting. Look, the Americans are getting a bit of a bloody nose in Iran. But anyway, what happened after that was fascinating, as Dr. Roy Casagrande explains.
In that same year, 1979, a group of college students get a crazy idea. What if we broke into, this is what they're saying, this is their dialogue, the U.S. Embassy, and we could get a hold of the CIA documents that show that the U.S. overthrew the democracy in 53. Then we could show the world, and maybe the United States would apologize for it. And then we could start healing from this wound. And so a group of college students start heading to the U.S. Embassy. Well, most of the U.S. Embassy staff had already been evacuated. There were like 4 civilians left at that point, and they get word that the students are coming, and they escape to the Canadian Embassy. But there's 66 CIA operatives still there, because Iran wasn't just the headquarters for the CIA operations in Iran. Iran was the headquarters for CIA operations in Asia. So basically everything from Turkey to China operated out of Tehran, to the point where we had the minting plates for $20 bills there. So San Francisco, Denver, Philadelphia, and Tehran. That's where we minted U.S. money. Those are the official mints. Isn't that cool? Because the CIA needed the cash. Right? When it's overthrowing democracies, that's not cheap. You gotta pay for that stuff. $20 bills are a fantastic way to pay for everything, it turns out. The brand new Islamic Republic that doesn't want anything to do with what the students are about to do calls the U.S. Embassy. Because the U.S. Embassy is officially United States of America. So as soon as those kids climb over the wall, they're in the United States of America trespassing. This is an international incident. And so they call the embassy. They're like, dude, get the rest of your staff out. What are you doing there? And the CIA guys are like, nothing, as they're shredding the documents. They got to stay there. They got to get everything shredded. And so they're just sitting there at the shredders going, we're just going to stay here a little longer. The Iranian government's like, no, you got to go. What are you doing? They're obeying orders. The students climb over the wall and they capture the 66 CIA operatives in the act of shredding the documents. They'd already gotten a bunch of the documents shredded. Those college students shove those shredded documents in garbage bags. They walk over to the nearby middle schools and high schools. They go, you guys like making puzzles, right? And they put the documents back together. In our words, piece by piece, we document how Kermit Roosevelt overthrew the democracy in 1953. The students go, here it is. They make copies, give it for free to the whole world. Too bad there wasn't an internet back then. They'd have loved that. They give it away to the whole world, free documents. And then they go, okay, President Carter, go ahead, apologize. No way. We're the United States of America. Even though we've lost wars, we'll never admit it. And we're definitely never going to apologize. And so we refused. Carter wasn't going to do it. So the student said, we won't release the hostages until you do. Carter's like, I don't care. Don't. Keep them there. Just CIA operatives. No one cares. And then the students go, but you know what else we have? We have the names of all your operatives in China and in Southeast Asia and in India and in Pakistan. And you sure you don't want to apologize? And Carter didn't do it. And so they published all of it. In an instant, the CIA is massacred. Not literally. They just had to pull all their operatives out of the field because now the Chinese knew their name and where they were. Now everybody knew their names and where they were. And so the CIA had to start over. So that there's no denying what we did, but we're not going to apologize for it, and we're not going to get the hostages released. And so time's passing. Ted Koppel creates a new TV show, Nightline. It's going to be at night. He's going to have like fun music to start the show, and then every show is going to start with how many days the innocent victim hostages have been held in captivity in Iran. And it became like this clock measuring time. And Carter's popularity rating just kept going down, down, down. And then came rumors of the October surprise. And at this point, the hostages are like in hell for a year. And there was talk that Carter had done it. He had successfully negotiated the release of the hostages. And now they were going to get released October 1980. November 1980 is the Reagan-Carter election. Now, so for the record, this is not 100% proven. It's just mostly proven. What happened was the Reagan campaign sent a group of men. They met with Rafsanjani. They came with briefcases. They put the briefcases on a desk, and they said, we'd like for you to hold the hostages at least until after the election. Rafsanjani went, I thought you said you were from the United States. They go, we are. And Rafsanjani goes, what's in the suitcases? And they go, you'll like it. It wasn't $20 bills. It was more. And so he opens it up, and he goes, you know what? I'm going to see what I can do. He had successfully negotiated with the students to release the hostages. He goes back and he renegotiates with them to keep the hostages. The election happened. Reagan wins. Carter doesn't know this has happened. So he's still got his sleeves rolled up, negotiating, trying to get the hostages released. He's negotiating while Reagan's being inaugurated. Like, he was so determined to make it happen. And of course, moments after Reagan is inaugurated president, they release the hostages as planned so that Reagan can get credit for it. So the hostages get released, and then Reagan decides that it would be really fun to do a proxy war with Iran. And what the United States does is it goes to Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq, and says, you have a grievance with Iran, isn't that correct? And Saddam Hussein said, yeah, our border on the Shatt al-Arab isn't quite resolved, and we'd like that straightened out. And he goes, and the Reagan guys are like, yeah, but couldn't your grievance go beyond that? And they go, what do you mean? And go, isn't Khuzestan Arab? That's the Arab part of Iran. Wouldn't it be better if an Arab country ruled the Arab part of Iran? And Saddam Hussein went, you know, now that you mention it, that does sound like a good idea. And so the Reagan guys say, well, they just decapitated their military. It's like Stalin's purges. It's going to take them forever to recover from this. Attack them now. We'll supply you. We'll run you the weapons, whatever you need. And Saddam Hussein obliges. And in 1981, Iraq attacks Iran. It's a not 8-year long war. It's a complete disaster for both Iran and Iraq. The low number is three quarters of a million Iranians die, 250,000 Iraqis die. The high number is just double that. Nothing is gained. The border doesn't really change in any meaningful way. And the world is not better off for having done it. The war ends. And Iran that whole time then is in emergency mode. So whether you like the theocracy or not didn't matter. This is life and death. This is survival. There's this catastrophic war where Iranians are losing a huge number of lives. Three people die for every Iraqi. So even though the war is a stalemate, there's no real winner in this thing, the cost to Iran was catastrophic and through the roof. And so Iranians were willing to fight for the Islamic Republic, whether they liked it or not, because this was a matter of nationalism and national identity. And then the war ends. Pretty much for no reason other than the Ayatollah Khomeini goes, you know what, why not? Let's stop. Saddam Hussein kept saying, please, let's stop. This isn't going anywhere. He's like, no, he turned it into a holy war. Saddam Hussein's like, I'm an idiot for starting the war. I should have never trusted the Americans.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a fascinating tale of the history, the build-up. I mean, many of us remember, as I do, the Iran-Iraq War. We didn't really know why they were fighting each other. Now we do. It's because the Americans wanted Saddam, basically weaponized Iraq through Saddam Hussein to start a war with Iran because they had humiliated the Americans by grabbing all their hostages and also by getting all the information about the CIA's activities all over Asia, to publishing it across Asia. Of course, there was no, as you said, there was no internet at the time. But if you all got all these American agents in China and everywhere else, and you know who they, you then know who they are, this is maybe what we need is someone else to do something similar today to stop World War III. We want to know who and where all these agents are. Maybe we could do the same for China too. Where are all the Chinese agents, please? Because these are the people who, even though they don't necessarily understand the bigger picture, they're just doing their job. They're low down the pyramid, but the people up the pyramid will understand exactly what they're doing. So, for example, in the Gladio attacks across Italy in the 1980s and 1990s, what you had was you had people going in who were members of the armed forces, police, special forces, people like that. For example, they go and say, we can do a reconnaissance of this supermarket. When do they open up? How do they open up? How many people are there? What time is the busiest time? What's the quietest time? So you go and you do this reconnaissance and you think nothing of it. And then a few months later, you realize some lunatics with clown masks have gone into the supermarket at its busiest time and machine gunned a whole load of people. And they're saying that they are a certain faction, which no one's ever heard of. I think it was possibly actually the Red Brigade. People like that were framed for some of these sorts of attacks. Axion Direct, it was what it was called, I think, in Belgium in the Brabant massacres. But this is what they're doing because only the people at the top know what the evil plan is. The Freemasons or whoever they happen to be, you know, the very, very top. So anyway, I think that's a fascinating bit of an insight. I'd also like to share with you this week a little bit about Dennis Wheatley, because Matt and I obviously have different points of view, but I'm quite convinced that Wheatley was right. He was in the intelligence services in the Second World War. He was brought in as a wing commander into the deception planning department in Whitehall, having been a novelist before the war and a fantastic novelist at that. But what sparked me to take a little bit of a fresh interest in him was going through Lymington the other week, as I think I mentioned last week's show. What we had was a little chit-chat with a lady there who was talking about Britain being the head of the snake. She sort of sparked me off. And as I looked around the old place where Dennis Wheatley lived for 20 years down there, and which failed to sell because of the superstition around his occult novels, I realised that there is nothing in Lymington, but down by the Isle of Wight in the New Forest, at the end of the edge of the New Forest on the Solent. There's nothing there about Dennis Wheatley at all. It's like he's been cancelled before cancelling was a thing. So he died in the mid-1970s, but there's just nothing about him. And his house was demolished. The only thing that's really left is the wavy walls along, I think it's at Grove Place, which is one of the street he lived on. And he had a large 3-acre house there, 2-storey house. And inside one of the urns, he left a thing called a letter to austerity. But anyway, he was most very much like me, a dualist about good versus evil, dark versus light. And the idea is a sort of final battle between good and evil coming Armageddon in the future, which I think seems more and more obvious, especially with things like the mark of the beast, the weaponization of AI, and the idea of kind of fake humans being around through AI, the creation of life, which is of course what the occult have been wanting to do for many years, a mimicry of it all, really. It's not the proper stuff, it's just a pretend version, and they're trying to con you to think it is. So anyway, let's have a listen to Dennis Wheatley and his discussion here. He talks a little bit about this. Is there's not many interviews around with him about how he believes society is actually disintegrating. And this is way back in, this is recorded, I think, in the late 1960s, early 1970s.
You say that today the powers of darkness in its eternal war, the power of darkness in its eternal war with the power of light, is threatening to come out on top. If this continues on an ever-increasing scale, the inevitable result will be a return to the brutal lawlessness, poverty, and insecurity of the Dark Ages. Do you really believe that about the modern
day? I do believe that. The violence and that sort of thing that's going on today is unbelievable, and the government are not controlling it. And that doesn't go only for this country. It's all over Europe and the United States worse than ever. And they've just got to take a line.
Well, give me an example of how the power of darkness, as you call it, is operating in this town, in this country today.
Well, there are said to be over 300 covens in this country. Covens, that is 13 people making up a coven of witches. And they're increasing every day, I suppose, because the two world wars have made great insecurity with young people, and they're looking for something, you must have something to cling on to, and they are tempted by these evil people, not necessarily people who have real power, but evil people, to come to these parties, who promise you want to marry the boss, all right, you come along on Tuesday, you have a little fun and that sort of thing, and so on. And that is where an immense amount of dope pushing, that sort of thing, goes on, because witches and their servants have always used drugs.
Do you know, have you met modern witches?
When I first wrote my first book on black magic, before I wrote it, I took trouble to get an introduction to Aleister Crowley, to Rollo Ahmed, to Harry Price, Montague Summers, all of whom were top boys in that line. And I used to have them to lunch and dinner and talk to them. I had many conversations, but I've never dabbled in it myself, because I am absolutely certain no good can come of it. You probably get so interested in this thing, but you neglect your wife, you neglect your job, and there it is. If you're weak-minded, you can end up in a loony bin.
I wonder if you don't perhaps sometimes feel a sense of responsibility yourself for the state of affairs, because there is no doubt your books sell in absolutely fabulous numbers. Your
they
books
do?
About black magic. Are you catering for the very thing that you are against?
I can't believe that, because in every book I write, I always give a warning that this thing is evil, and no good can ever come to anybody who dabbles in it.
You haven't quite answered my question. Aren't you feeding the curiosity that is creating this evil?
No, I don't. I feel that by warning people, so many people are drawn into this thing, and I feel that I, at least, am in warning them. It's not a good thing to do.
Do you think they might ever strike at you?
No, I have complete confidence in my own protection, because they can only strike at people who are afraid and who believe that they can be harmed. And I don't. I don't say that I'm particularly good person, but I believe that I'm on the right side, and I believe the powers of light will protect me from anything that anybody could ever attempt about me.
But you're fearful the powers of darkness may take us over.
I think that civilization is disintegrating. Unless somebody takes a pull, things are getting worse and worse every year.
Well, that's Dennis Wheatley, and his letter to posterity. I'll put up a link to that as well, which he left in his little urn there, saying, look, basically everybody, and in fact, you may even hear it in the podcast at the beginning of the show, he's saying the best thing to do if things like this do go this way in Britain is just rebel. So here he is. He's a sort of, I suppose, you know, today, if Wheatley was around, he'd be a Reform UK supporter. And, you know, he was quite a British nationalist, but had all sorts of fascinating things to say. Of course, he was brought up before the First World War, right? So remember, there was completely different attitudes in the generation that Wheatley was part of. Anyway, finally this week, I think it would be nice to hear a little bit more up to date about Christian Zionism, particularly because this seems to be one of the most pernicious things ever. And Dr. Ali Atai, I don't know quite who he is, but I came across this film a couple of weeks ago, which is doing a great job, I think, in going into the origins of this and how there was an American movement around about the same time as the Christian Zionists got going into Zionism. And Zionism itself was promulgated, as well as the letter by Albert Pike to Mazzini, which was the plan for three world wars. First of all, First World War, wipe the Ottoman Empire out from Palestine. Second World War, create an Israeli state. Third World War, have a massive battle between the Muslims and the Zionists, and then discredit the Abrahamic faiths forever. During that war, that was his basic plan. But anyway, at the same time, other things were going on, and that was a complete remaking. And apparently, there was no expense spared on the financial side to promulgate this new idea of Christian Zionism.
Traditionally,
Christians believed that Christians are now the chosen people, right? The Jews are no longer the chosen people. For Christians to support the building of a third temple is absolutely blasphemous, because in the New Testament, Jesus is clearly described as being the new temple, the final temple. In Romans 6 and in Hebrews 10, you know, Paul says that Jesus was the be-all, end-all sacrifice. He's the ultimate temple. He's the ultimate high priest, the ultimate sacrifice. And yet Christian Zionists, they fully support the third temple, where sin sacrifices will apparently return one day, according to Jewish messianism. So Christian Zionism is just indefensible from a biblical perspective. So what actually happened here? How did Zionism become so popular among American Protestants? Well, in 1831, there was this Anglican preacher named John Nelson Darby. Okay. And so he was one of the primary organizers of a non-denominational Christian movement called the Plymouth Brethren. So you know, this is what happens when church tradition is ignored. So Darby is considered to be the father of something called modern dispensationalism. Okay. So what is modern dispensationalism? So this is basically, it's this notion that there will be a future restoration of the earthly nation of Israel. But this also includes this idea that the Mosaic covenant and the Christic covenant are two valid coexisting covenants. They're both valid. Okay. This is also known as dual covenant theology. In other words, Christians do not need to convert Jews. The Jews already have a valid covenant. Jews are still chosen by God, irrespective of their belief in Jesus. Okay. So if we just think about the theological implications of this for Christianity, I mean, this implies that Christ only came for the Gentiles, not the Jews. That's the implication, that it actually directly contradicts the New Testament Jesus. You know, when he said, "I was not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel," right? So, you know, instead of, you know, "For God so loved the world," he should have said, "For God so loved the Gentiles," that he gave his only begotten son, because the Jews don't need him. At least not yet. So according to Darby, let's get into his eschatology then, that Christ will rule the reconstituted physical ethnic Jewish state of Israel. So national Israel will be restored, according to Darby. According to Darby, the Old Testament prophesizes not so much the church age, but really the kingdom, the millennium, where Christ rules the national Jewish state of Israel. And Darby was also a dual covenant dispensationalist. So what does that mean? Again, this means that the Mosaic covenant and the Christic covenant are two valid coexisting covenants. They're both valid. So when Jesus returns to rule over national Israel, all of Israel will eventually believe in him. Right, and there's going to be a reversal. He came the first time, they almost all rejected him. When he comes the second time, they will all believe in him.
Okay.
Now Darby was famous for saying that the Bible must be rightly divided. This is a very famous phrase from Darby. He actually takes it from the letters of Paul, but Paul uses it in a different way. The Bible must be rightly divided. What he meant was that much of the New Testament does not actually apply to Christians, but only to Jews. That Jesus, primarily in the synoptic gospel, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he's actually teaching the Mosaic covenant, okay? But in John's gospel, as well as through Paul's writings, Jesus was advancing the Christian covenant. So there's almost like two gospels. So according to Darby, Jesus was teaching both dispensations, okay? Both covenants are valid, side by side. Now, Darby's dispensationalism eventually found its way across the pond to America. So Pastor James Hall Brooks, he kind of just fell in love with Darby, with his teachings, right? Don't get the wrong idea. And then Brooks, he was in St. Louis, and there was an annual Bible conference called the Niagara Bible Conference. And Brooks was often the keynote speaker. So it was at this conference when Darbyan dispensationalism became more and more popular via James Brooks. And Brooks had a preacher friend named Dwight Moody. And Moody would later establish the famous Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, where Bible is their middle name, as Bart Ehrman always says. And then Moody also became a Darbyan dispensationalist. And then Moody befriended a man named Cyrus Ingerson Schofield. Okay. Now, Schofield was a morally questionable lawyer and politician. He was accused of multiple charges of theft, bribery, forgery. He was a deadbeat husband and father, a self-described alcoholic, turned Christian minister. So he became an ordained pastor in Dallas in 1883. Hmm. Schofield. In 1888, he wrote a treatise called Rightly Dividing the Word of Truth. Rightly Dividing the Word of Truth. So he started calling himself C.I. Schofield, D.D., that is Doctor of Divinity, although there's no record of him ever graduating from seminary. So it seemed like he gave himself kind of an honorary doctorate, kind of like what Dartmouth College did for Dr. Seuss. Right? Honorary doctorate. Dr. Seuss wasn't a real doctor. C.I. Schofield was not a real doctor. Mm. In 1909, Schofield wrote his Schofield Study Bible. This was published by Oxford. So this Bible, the Schofield Study Bible, had a massive, massive impact on American Protestants and evangelicals. It is no exaggeration that this Bible turned millions of American Protestants into Christian Zionists. I mean, it changed a generation of preachers. His Bible translation is essentially the King James translation, but he added all of these strange notes in his commentary. So in his commentary of Genesis 12:3, okay, so this is the most infamous one. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is God's promise to Abraham. Okay, so Schofield's commentary changed the game. So basically God says to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you.
So, yeah, that's Dr. Ali Attai, and I'll put a link up to the YouTube on thisweek.org.uk later. How Christians became Christian Zionists, dispensationalism. In 1831, Plymouth Brethren, John Nelson Darby in the Schofield Study Bible. Fascinating. I think, you know, this is how we need to understand this is a plan. This genocide that's going on now has been planned for a long, long time, folks. That's one of the reasons why it's so important to take a step back. The idea is these people are not doing it just within their own generation. They're a bunch that have been working on this for a long time. And they think that because we don't think that there could be multi-generational cults. Well, actually, sorry, we know there are multi-generational cults. So the Dennis Wheatley references, I've got a couple of quotes here from him, or actually one main quote. And it's from a book which he published in 1941. That is the closing paragraphs of a book called Strange Conflict, which I'm guessing is one of his occult books. He says, in the New World Order, all family life will be at an end, except for the conquerors. Only the worst elements, spiritually, will be allowed to procreate fresh generations to populate a world divided into masters and slaves. The right to homes and children of their own would be reserved to the overlords. The rest will be herded into barracks and reduced to the level of robots, without the right to read or speak or even think for themselves. There could be no revolt because every officer, priest, deputy, editor, magistrate, writer, or other leader of free thought and action in the conquered countries would already have been executed by a firing squad. The leaderless herds cannot prevail against tanks, tear gas, bombs, and machine guns. And unless men are free, how can they progress upon the great spiritual journey which all must make? This war is not for territory or gain or glory, but that Armageddon which was prophesied of old. That is why all the children of light, wherever they may be, captive or free, must hold on to their spiritual integrity as never before, and must stick at nothing physically in the fight, lest the whole world fall under the domination of these puppets who are animated by the powers of darkness. Amazing to think. I mean, of course, this is in the shadow of the Second World War. I think of Wheatley actually as a kind of, you know, another George Orwell in a lot of ways. He's an insider who gets a bit of a whiff that there's something going on out here. If you go to his book The Devil and All His Works, which I think was published in 1971, in one of the sections there, Dennis Wheatley talks about Winston Churchill being, he thinks it's he would be he talks about whether or not Winston Churchill was a member of the Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt. And he then says it would not be at all surprising if it were so. So he's a sort of a bit of a whistleblower in a way, I think, Wheatley. And so it's not surprising that they've tried to erase him from history. What we're talking about now is we're talking about the Labour Party, the City of London, and the powers that be in Britain today starting to bring about a kind of regime of Gauleiters as there were in Nazi Germany in the 1930s. So I think we need to be very much aware of this kind of thing not being allowed to happen again. Since it was such a disaster last time, they seem to be trying very hard through the cults, the secret societies, Freemasonry, etc., to bring this in. Anyway, this is Bristol. It was Bristol. It was Friday. It is now a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, who was, of course, the free speech activist, Kiwi, Matt O'Brannan, and also to the interviewee, Neil Goodwin, as well as Don DeBar, both of which there'll be long versions up of those on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Please download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. You can send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel, WhatsApp or whatever. You can go to the show page where you get the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page. Also, you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for all those that have subbed, by the way, because we've been using a little bit of that cash this week to get a couple of new laptops, and it really helps to have that little bit of money in the background to keep the show rolling. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks, you can get those both through the Bilderberg website, the www.bilderberg.org, where there's also free downloads. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Sorry, there's been a lot of technical trouble this week with the live stream. Hopefully that will be sorted. In a way, we've been, and Dave has been busily scurrying away troubleshooting as the show's gone on to find out why the live stream kept dropping out. But looks like we may have sorted that one out now. Hope you can hear me. Do please make live recordings of the show. We've been streaming live at talkradio.org.uk, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us or rebroadcast live, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show, hopefully with Martin back next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be a dictator. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Muslim, black, white, refugee, migrant. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise anyone. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everybody. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned man's soul, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into bloodshed and misery. We've developed speed but shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance now leaves us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the internet have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in people, cries out for universal brotherhood and sisterhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent lives. To those people, I promise, the hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people shall return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Police, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourself to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You're not machines. You're not cattle. You're human. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hates, the unloved and the unnatural. Police, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. Because you, the people, have the power. The power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. So in the name of humanity, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world that gives people the chance to work, that gives youth a future and old age security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise, and they never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress leads to everyone's happiness. People, in the name of humanity, let us all unite. Shalom, salam, peace.
Wow, Neil Goodwin, thanks very much for joining us.
Ah, welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. nothing.